On eBay, every find has a story. Like if you're looking for a vintage Banty. Not just the tee, the Banty. You wore it everywhere. Until your BFF stole it. Now you're on eBay. And there it is. Same tee, from the same tour. The things you love have a way of finding their way back to you. Especially on eBay. Where else can you find that mint trading card you searched everywhere for? Or your first car, the one you wished you never sold? It has to be eBay. Shop eBay for millions of finds, each with a story. eBay. Things people love.
It's Bretzky. I don't know how they let me on this podcast, but while I'm here, I might as well tell you the only place to play blackjack, roulette, and live craps in Texas is SpinQuest.com, baby. That's SpinQuest.com. New users get a $30 coin package for only $10. I mean, that's a hell of a deal for all you 10-gallon hat wearers down there in Texas.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
I mentioned yesterday briefly the Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. It was kind of interesting, the history of this. And there's an interview on World Magazine, WNG.org. They talked to Bruce Forbes. He's a holiday historian and an author of Christmas, A Candid History. He said, everybody thinks, well, this is the way they celebrated Christmas back in Victorian England. He said, actually, it wasn't a portrait of Victorian Christmas at the time. Dickens made Christmas popular when it was not popular at the time. And he points out, going back to the 1600s, English Puritans tried to stamp out Christmas celebrations based on two main objections. Number one, they said, well, it's not in early Christianity, so we're not called to do it. Number two, is there too much wild partying going on? And again, the way I look at it is, some people look at one day as holier than another. Other people see every day as alike. Let everybody follow their conscience. And it depends on how you celebrate it. Is it going to be wild partying? Is it going to be rampant materialism? Or is it going to be an opportunity to reflect on the incarnation of Christ and his purpose? And so Parliament even went so far as to ban Christmas in 1647. The historian Forbes said at some points they would send town criers around on Christmas Eve crying, "No Christmas! No Christmas!" What would Megyn Kelly say? And Bill O'Reilly, these are the people who used to always talk about the war on Christmas every year. Forbes said, for a century or more, Christmas remained diminished. A survey of stories, as a matter of fact, from the London Times between 1790 and 1836 shows just how much Christmas had fallen out of favor. In 20 of those years, nothing at all was said about Christmas, and in the other 25, it's mentioned only briefly, in the kind of sense of, well, that's something that people used to do a long time ago. Dickens wrote A Christmas Carol in just 6 weeks, and he published it a few days before Christmas on December the 19th, 1843. He was up against a deadline and just barely making it, like we did with this book in the bookmark, you know. Anyway, the public reaction was instant. They loved it. It sold out. They printed it over and over, reprints over and over again in the following years. And it got very big in America as well. In 1868, Dickens sailed to the U.S. to perform dramatic readings of his books, including A Christmas Carol. I used to watch Bonanza when I was a kid, and I remember they had an episode of Charles Dickens in America, and he went to the ranch, you know. He got to meet the Cartwrights, I guess, because they got a lot of money. Anyway, Forbes said, it's like he was like a rock star. He had 150 people waiting overnight to get tickets in Boston, and the tickets all sold out. So he said, A Christmas Carol expressed Dickens' deep concern for the poor. And see, this is why, you know, when my friend who was from the Libertarian Party, he got so upset about Dickens because he saw this as the wedge that was used to enact socialism, right? When in reality, you know, we understand that they use children, as I said before, they're always, children are always, and the welfare of children is always the poster child for whatever it is that they want to do, whether it's setting up a digital ID on the internet or whatever it is. And yet we do need to be concerned about the welfare of children. It's just that we don't need to do it through government. And we do need to be concerned about the poor, and yet we shouldn't do it through government. And even though he wasn't advocating helping the people out through government, he even points out, you know, that one point, he said, well, don't we have poorhouses and institutions like that? And you look at how the government had failed to help the poor in that. It really was an individual concern. And I think that was a key thrust of A Christmas Carol. And so the story of Ebenezer Scrooge's transformation grabbed a hold of the public mind and added a new layer of meaning to the holiday, one which laid the groundwork for widespread Christmas celebrations, even among those who don't believe Christ came as a baby in a manger. And that's the other thing about it. You know, we need to understand the, you know, when you look at Dickens' Christmas Carol, that was one thing that always kind of bothered me. You know, it's kind of like the beginning of It's a Wonderful Life and the phony angel narrative that's there. You know, how we're going to, you know, manipulate this guy's life in order to do various things. Still, helping the poor is not something that we should despise. Nevertheless, it's not, as Dickens puts it out there, it's not that good works are going to win us the favor of God. There are rewards for good works in both this life and the next life, but you got to make sure that you make the next life. And the good works are not going to give you eternal life. That's what Christ came for, and that's the message, I think, should be of Christmas. As Forbes said, generosity becomes the theme that people can embrace, whether they're Christian or not, or whether they're religious or not. Generosity is a beautiful thing, and it's, I think, Dickens' Christmas Carol's greatest contribution. It shifts what Christmas becomes. And he made it a secular orientation. You know, Jesus said, I am the way, and no one comes to the Father but by me, right? It's a very narrow way. It's only one person wide. You come through or by Christ, or you don't come at all to eternal life. And that is the message of Christmas, really. You know, some will say that, you know, we've seen Bloomberg say many times, they say, well, if there is a heaven, I'm going straight in because of all the good things that I've done. So everybody can come up with their own set of things that they think earned them salvation. God will not be impressed. You know, when we disobey him, we have rebelled against him. And that's why we don't realize how serious that is. And we don't realize why we need Christ. But, you know, helping the poor, having health care for Tiny Tim, those are all great things. But, you know, the socialists have made those things that the government does. And so today, you know, if they were to come around, Ebenezer Scrooge would say, well, don't we have welfare programs for those things? I don't need to help anybody. And he would miss the personal reward of helping someone like that. You know, these are all good things, but still the only way to have that life is through the Lord Jesus Christ. You know, Dickens' story, I also thought about the fact that he has these three ghosts in it, right, that come back, and they're the ones that, you know, reason with Scrooge and convince him. And I always thought, you know, that's really very much like a twisted version of the story that Jesus gave about Lazarus and the rich man in Luke 16. And I don't think that's a parable. I think that's a real story. He uses real names, even references Abraham. He doesn't mention the name of the rich man because of the context of the story. You realize why he doesn't mention that. But, you know, we could just call him Scrooge, for example, right? And or say Marley. It would be Marley, not Scrooge. Because the rich man, as he's in torment, he begs Abraham. He said, let me go back and warn my family about this. You know, I don't want my brothers to make the same mistakes that I have made. And kind of like Marley, right? Except what does Abraham say to him? He said, well, they have the law and the prophets, and if they won't listen to them, they won't listen to somebody that comes back from the dead. I think about that every time I watch the show. So what would he tell them, right? What would he tell them about that? And what would they learn from the law and the prophets? Well, when Jesus was confronted with the religious leaders, he said, you search the scriptures, that is the law and the prophets, because you think in them you will find eternal life, but they testify of me. And they do. And that is the message of Christmas as well. The prophecies and the whole narrative of the Old Testament all points to Christ. It's not about the end of the world. It's not about Zionism. It's not about any of that stuff and what happens to Israel, what happens at the end of the world. No, even that's such a misreading of Revelation. People will often call it Revelations. And I think it's because they think of it as revelations about the end of the world. But the actual title is The Revelation of Jesus Christ. That's what the Bible is from start to finish. And so it testifies of him. And the law and the prophets testify. So, Marley's not going to go back and tell Scrooge this. Scrooge has got the law and the prophets. And if he doesn't want to see what they have to say about Christ, then, that's the real message of Christmas, Charlie Brown. So that's the reason that we celebrate it.
Yeah. It's always any chance you have to remember what Christ has done for you, for everyone.
That's right. And to tell people, what is the end of the Christmas story? And nobody ever kept Christmas like Ebenezer Scrooge kept Christmas. So it's like, is that it? Is that the moral of the story? It kind of has an anticlimactic ending here, right? He still dies at some point in time, but they remembered him fondly because he was very generous with everybody. Well,
no one put up more wreaths than Ebenezer.
I hope that that you enjoy the reward of that, and that is a rewarding thing, but that is not the ultimate thing. We'll be right back.
That's right, boys and girls. There's a post-election sale on silver and gold. Trump euphoria has caused a dip in silver and gold. And it's time to buy some metals with fiat dollars before they come to their sense. Is go to davidknight.gold to get in touch with the wise wolf himself, Tony Arterburn. He knows where to look to find silver and gold.
Hey, it's Ben Ferguson, and I want to be honest with you for a second about how an act of compassion really feels. A couple of years ago, I made the choice to partner with an amazing organization called Compassion International. Why? Because I wanted to sponsor a child in need. It was a nice idea, sure. But I had no idea just how much that simple act would change my life as well. I sponsored Nadia and got to watch her life change right in front of my eyes, going from starving literally alone on the streets to getting the health care and education she needs to reach her God-given full potential. I got to be a part of that change, and the light of that compassion not only illuminates in her, it illuminates now in me. That is the power of compassion. The light of Christ shines on all of us. Feel it for yourself and change literally a child's life. Change the world, and you also change yourself. You can sponsor a child today. Visit compassion.com. That's compassion.com.
What's up, baby? It's Bretzky, and I'm here to tell you that SpinQuest.com is giving out free sweeps coins. All you gotta do is purchase a $10 coin pack, and guess what? They're gonna give you the coins from a $30 coin pack. That lets you play all your favorite games like Blackjack, Wanted, Dead or Wild, and we're talking real cash prizes, baby. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Oh! York, the York.
Welcome back, and joining us now is Zoe Smith. She has set up a website, thrillkillmedicalcult.com. You can also find her on Substack. The name of the Substack is Zoe, that's Z-O-W-E, .substack.com. And we want to talk to her about being a whistleblower and the things that she saw during the pandemic lockdown. Zoe worked as a medical coder for over a decade. Tell us a little bit about that. What was that involved with? Was that for insurance purposes, identifying the procedures and putting the right code on it?
Yeah. Hi. So. Thanks for the invite. Thanks for being here. Yeah. So a medical coder, a lot of people don't even know that it exists because you don't really see it as a patient. But everything that happens to you in a hospital, clinic, x-ray, lab, whatever, has to have a diagnosis and procedure assigned. And that's how your doctor gets paid. So the coder is the one who reviews that documentation, assigns the right diagnosis code, assigns the right procedure code, and that's what gets put on the bill and that your insurance or Medicare uses to pay your doctor or the lab or the hospital for their services.
Yes.
So it was really boring until COVID happened. And then,
you had a bird's eye view of what was going on. I was just telling you off air, I said the aha moment for me was the AHA, the American Hospital Association, and I believe it was August of 2020. I've talked about this many times. They got very upset because they said to CMS, who was paying them, they said, "You told us that we didn't have to have a PCR documentation for this. You said that you didn't have enough of them, and you said they didn't work. And you said we could just point at somebody to a clinical diagnosis, and you would give us a 20% bonus on everything that we did to the people, as well as the upfront cash bonus of $13,000. And now you want to have this this new requirement. You know, that's not fair." So they were complaining because they weren't getting paid, and it kind of exposed the whole thing, except nobody would cover that. It was amazing to me how there was dead silence everywhere about that. I mean, you incentivize people to that degree, and I would always say to people, look, the money is the issue. You know, the declaration of the emergency by Trump unleashed the money, and then they put out these rules through CMS and paid these people to kill, is really what was happening.
Absolutely.
And that's what you saw as well, right?
Yeah, that's they did. I don't know if you're familiar with the vaxxed bus, but Children's Health Defense, they sent out a third one. So they've done a part one, part two, and now a part three. The part three is called Authorized to Kill for that reason, because the CARES Act really did. It incentivized a behavior change in hospitals and with physicians and how they were able to practice medicine. It set everything on its head and it incentivized everything. What you're talking about, what the AHA said about you didn't even need a PCR test result to get that COVID diagnosis is absolutely correct. And that was one of the things that I noticed in the Pandora's box of things that changed right in at when they declared 2 weeks to flatten the curve in March of 2020. They changed all the coding rules as well. So they April 1st, 2020 is when the COVID-19 diagnosis went into effect. And we were actually told to commit fraud before that time because we didn't have a code to reflect COVID-19 and we needed to track that so much. And of course, everyone had to get the PCR test in order to get the diagnosis. But then there was this official coding guideline, which is what we use as coders. It's like our Bible. It tells us what's correct, what's fraud, and it's essentially, it lays out the rules. And in those rules, there's a part that says, in order to be diagnosed with COVID-19, all your physician needs to do is write down in their medical opinion that they think that you have COVID-19. They didn't need to do an exam. They didn't need to have a PCR test result. And it says right in that official guideline, this is an exception to Section 2H inpatient coding guidelines, which says for every other diagnosis, they have to do an exam and they have to have some sort of clinical documentation, usually some sort of lab work or diagnostics to prove their working diagnosis. So COVID was an exception for that. And that was one of the really big red flags that came up for me. And of course, I noticed in my position, not only is everyone getting this PCR test when we come in, they're not all sick, but then they get this COVID-19 diagnosis. And the part that most people, that still a lot of people aren't familiar with, is when they did the 2 weeks to flatten the curve and they locked down everybody, they actually kicked people out of the ICU early.
Yeah.
and they shut down other wings of the hospital. They went down to a skeleton crew. So they consolidated wings within the hospital. So the ER and the ICU stayed open, mm-hmm. but the rest of the hospital was shut down. We were getting furloughed and laid off and hiring freezes and no raises, no bonuses during the time when the media was saying, these healthcare heroes are showing up to fight the onslaught of COVID-19 patients. Well, it was an onslaught of false positive tests, but it wasn't an onslaught of a whole bunch of patients. We were getting furloughed. So the hospital really, really needed that money because they were bankrupted yeah. right before those incentives came out. So they really needed those incentives.
Yeah.
So they were absolutely excited to label someone as COVID-19 and get that 20% diagnosis and then hook them up to the ventilator, which they got another bonus for.
Oh, yeah.
And then the remdesivir, which they were giving out like candy during this entire time, the bonus really didn't go into effect until August of 2020, but they were using it from about April all the way through. And mm-hmm. I noticed how the protocols were killing people. And mm-hmm. and doctors would just say, oh, this is a progression of COVID-19. And to this day, a lot of people will say, I had a family member that died of COVID. They went to the hospital because they had COVID and they died of COVID. But I asked them, did they really die of COVID or did they die of the protocol? Were they not that sick until they got there and then
yeah.
then they circled the drain? Because in my experience, most of the patients within sometimes a few days to sometimes it took up to a month, but those protocols were killing people, shutting yeah. down their organs,
mm-hmm.
and then they would die. And that wasn't normal to have that happen to a pneumonia patient. Normally they'd be there 3 days. We pump them full of antibiotics, which we weren't using for COVID-19,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
then they would go home. Mm-hmm. So this was totally backwards. And then I started to notice all the incentives, because even as a coder, they have all these checks and balances in the electronic medical record system, and it counts against you if you miss something. So like if I missed someone for COVID-19, I would get a notice about it, like, oh, this is going to count against your score and might not get a raise this year because you weren't a good coder. And they were watching that for remdesivir because the bonuses were so much. On the bill, every single remdesivir infusion
mm-hmm.
was $4,000, give or take a little bit throughout the country because it's weighted based on like where you live. So it'd be more expensive in New York or California, but around $4,000
wow.
per dose
wow.
is how much they were getting.
Yeah, the ventilators. I interviewed a woman who was a nurse. She wrote a book called Pandemic Nurse, and she was in Florida, and she said, I wasn't seeing, you know, the kind of narrative that they were talking about with the pandemic, and everybody was saying it was all happening up in New York. So she left and went to New York to help and sat around for a couple of days before, after she told them she was there, before they brought her in. When they finally did bring her in, she's like, you know, what's going on? They're not busy either. When they brought her in, physician walked around, showed the people on the ventilators, and he said, you know, about 90% of these people are going to die. And she said it was horrible. They were just killing people. And of course, when you look at it, if you get a $13,000 bonus for pointing at somebody and saying they got COVID, they may not even be sick, as you pointed out. Then if you put them on a ventilator, you get $39,000 already. Right there, you got $52,000 for a machine that costs you $50,000, and then they will pay you 20% on the charges that you've got for them to use it, until you kill them with that ventilator. And again, pulmonologists were looking at this and come back and said, this never made any sense. We never did it like this. You're pointing out they give people antibiotics and other things like that. So we would never put people on a ventilator, you know, for pneumonia or things like that.
Exactly.
All of it was so incredibly corrupt and counterintuitive, and they turned the hospitals into killing machines for money. And everybody was willing to do that. I mean, if you got somebody that's there, and even if it wasn't an economic emergency that had been created partially by the government, you know, if you were to tell somebody, you point to that person and say they've got this condition, I'll give you $13,000. We know how human nature works, and we know how the corporate hospitals work. I mean, the incentives to do that are going to be huge, just like the disincentives to report somebody when they've had a reaction to the vaccines are going to be huge as well. Were you still there when they started the vaccination program, or had you left? Because you say that you left when they made the vaccine mandatory. Did you
right.
see it happening
yeah.
before that?
I started to wake up during really when they started declaring 2 weeks to flatten the curve and I started seeing people wearing masks in public, I knew this was not a pandemic and there mm-hmm. was some kind of psychological operation going on. Because mm-hmm. I had worked in the hospital for the swine flu scare.
Hey, it's Ben Ferguson, and I want to be honest with you for a second about how an act of compassion really feels. A couple of years ago, I made the choice to partner with an amazing organization called Compassion International. Why? Because I wanted to sponsor a child in need. It was a nice idea, sure, but I had no idea just how much that simple act would change my life as well. I sponsored Nadia and got to watch her life change right in front of my eyes, going from starving literally alone on the streets to getting the health care and education she needs to reach her God-given full potential. I got to be a part of that change, and the light of that compassion not only illuminates in her, it illuminates now in me. That is the power of compassion. The light of Christ shines on all of us. Feel it for yourself and change literally a child's life. Change the world, and you also change yourself. You can sponsor a child today. Visit compassion.com. That's compassion.com.
It's Bretzky. I don't know how they let me on this podcast, but while I'm here, I might as well tell you the only place to play blackjack, roulette, and live craps in Texas is SpinQuest.com, baby. That's SpinQuest.com. New users get a $30 coin package for only $10. I mean, that's a hell of a deal for all you 10-gallon hat wearers down there in Texas.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
And it wasn't a thing in the hospital. Like, it was just regular flu. I've even talked to people that were on the front lines, like ER doctors and nurses, and they said, some of them even said that they got it, and it wasn't that big of a deal. Mm-hmm. So when they declared COVID, I was really suspicious. This is just going to be another vaccination campaign, because they already had mandates for the flu shot for healthcare workers for like a decade before that. And I had been doing the exemption every year. And the reason I did that is because the first year that they made healthcare workers get the flu shot, everybody was getting the flu.
Yeah.
And so that was the year that we came up with it was just a rumor within the university lab where I worked, but everybody was saying it, that you get the flu from the flu shot. So ever since mm-hmm. then, I just didn't want to do it. Mm-hmm. So during that whole year of Operation Warp Speed, the only thing that's going to get us back to normal is this vaccine. I thought if the flu shot never worked, the chances that the COVID shot is going to work is slim to nil. And the amount of pressure for this one compared to the flu shot is astronomical. So there's something to it. So that made me actually not just look at the COVID shot, but look at all the other vaccines. Mm-hmm. And what I learned was they don't teach coders or doctors or nurses anything about vaccine side effects or adverse effects, mm-hmm. despite the fact that they have codes to assign for vaccine effects. But I would see patients come in with like Guillain-Barré before this, and the doctors would try very hard not to relate it to a vaccine. And there would be codes in there, like adverse effect of flu shot or adverse effect of whatever. And those are supposed to be like a safety signal code. Like one of the reasons why the ICD-10 system, which is owned by the WHO, by the way, so every member state that is part of the WHO has to report these codes, and it's for statistical monitoring purposes. So this is how they monitor pandemics. This is how they monitor cancer, like how many cases of cancer there are throughout the world, or heart problems or pneumonia cases. This is the system that they use. And it's also supposed to be used starting in clinical trials for devices and drugs to look for a safety signal.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought with this COVID-19 vaccine, there should be a code for adverse effect of this shot, and it should be my job to assign it. So I did my due diligence, and I looked into all the warnings and what could happen if people got the shot, and then I looked at what could happen if people got the other vaccines, and I started to realize that they had been varying all of the effects that people would get from vaccines and not assigning these adverse effect codes up until 2020. And then when the COVID-19 vaccine came out, there was no code to report it. So it should have been my job to collect that danger signal. And I even went on a podcast called Deborah Gets Red Pill. It was just a radio show in early 2021, right after I quit my job.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, the COVID-19 vaccine is more dangerous than all of the other vaccines combined. Mm-hmm. And that was with my, that was just an observation, mm-hmm. but it was 10 years of medical coding experience. And then learning what I learned about vaccine side effects and all the cases that I saw of children in the ER constantly having eczema or rashes or even anaphylactic responses. And then I look at the record and they just got a vaccine, but the doctor's not connecting the two. Mm-hmm. So when COVID-19 came out, people were having strokes and encephalitis and blood clots like I've never seen before. Myocarditis, they were getting COVID-19 immediately after getting the shot, like the same day or the next day, and then being hospitalized. There are people with paralytic problems, seizure disorders, blood disorders, where they couldn't even figure out what was going on because the patient was clotting and bleeding at the same time, and they didn't even know how to treat it.
Wow.
Crazy stuff started happening just in the first 4 months of the vaccine rollout. So it wasn't even available to the rest of the public yet. Mm-hmm. But by summer of 2021 is when they started saying, you at home, like this is the hospital leadership. They would have videos that they would send to all staff all the time monitoring COVID. And they were really, really pushing us to get that shot. They were saying, we're not doing as good as the other hospitals who are getting incentivized for meeting their vaccination quota. Mm-hmm. And we weren't. So they were pointing to us people who worked from home, who never saw patients, who never walked into a hospital. You guys are spreading it around society, and we're going to have to fire you if you don't get your shots. So at that point, I couldn't take it anymore. I knew that my job had been to get them money for murdering patients, and I was having a crisis of conscience over that. And then before the vaccine went out, I decided I was going to be a spy at that point and just see if the vaccine really was as bad as all the warnings said. And then it turned out to be far worse than I anticipated, and I didn't think that the chances would be very good that I would get a an exemption because mm-hmm. they changed the rules for getting an exemption. Mm-hmm. A lot of people got fired, and I didn't want to work for them anymore. I didn't want to continue helping them get money to murder people.
Good for you. Good for you. Yeah, you really did have.
That's why I chose to walk out.
You really did have a bird's eye view of this whole thing because you're seeing the diagnostic codes as well as the treatments that are there, and so you could get a good picture of what was actually coming on and seeing the trends that were there. That's very interesting, yeah. Your perspective. Yeah, I've got something, and I apologize because we can't feed this to you, so you can't hear this. I'll kind of talk about it and describe it, but I want the audience to hear what Lutnick, I call him Lucky Lutnick, what he said in terms about the money that can be made off of this kind of stuff. And he uses an example of the vaccines.
The United States government, the most powerful, the greatest customer, buys stuff. We walk in. We're going to buy, this is the example I like to use. We're going to buy 2 billion COVID vaccines. Mm-hmm. When we buy it, Pfizer and Moderna stocks are going to triple. They're going to triple. So then we say everyone's going to have this vaccine. If I were, after Jared Kushner negotiated the best deal he could, if Howard Lutnick walked in the room, Howard Lutnick would say, what do you think, 20% warrants? Right. 20% warrants?
Right.
Right? What? So we'd make $50 billion. Off of who? Nobody. We didn't take from anybody. We didn't do it. Okay, the shareholders of Pfizer, who we've just tripled them with our order.
Right.
Now, how many of my customers?
Yeah, Zoe, what he's saying, Zoe, says, yeah, you get, the U.S. government's the most powerful customer. So we're going to go in and we're going to buy $2 billion worth of these vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna. We're going to force people to take them. He goes, so I'm looking at this. I'm saying, well, I'm going to get some 20% warrants. I want some action of that. I know what's going to happen with all this. And he says, and, you know, and who have we harmed with all this stuff? It's like the people who got the shot, obviously. But he doesn't even see that. He sees nothing but dollar signs. This is the guy, of course, that is now the Commerce Secretary for Trump. And he's the guy who's pushing through the stable coins and all the rest of this stuff. Makes you wonder what he is going to be doing to us with the stable coins and the resetting of the financial system. These are people who see nothing other than money, and they don't care what they have to do to other people in order to make money. It truly is amazing, the greed and the system and the corruption.
Right. It is so hard for me to wrap my brain around how many people they killed. It was a silent genocide that is still invisible.
Yes.
But there's no family that I've talked to in the last 5 years that hasn't been touched by it in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Either someone they know is suffering from cancer, or some horrible chronic condition after getting the shot, or they've lost somebody. Like, I lost my cousin who was 17, who suddenly just drove into a tree, and they didn't do an autopsy or look into it. And there's countless other people out there like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this was our family. And people are still just kind of burying their heads in the sand and wanting to go on like it didn't happen.
The amazing thing,
our system is still set up to where it could still happen again. Like, we haven't even held those people accountable.
As a matter of fact, we put them back in office again. And so, you know, that's why, to me, I look at it, and what astounds me the most is just how effective the control of information has been. That's why what you're doing is so important. You've got to get out there and tell people what happened. Because, as you point out, almost everybody I know as well, there's been somebody in their family, immediate or extended family, that's been harmed by this. But everybody thinks that this is a one-off. It didn't happen to everybody else. They don't realize that it happened, how broad this is and how extensive it is. And they think that they're alone. Just like they wanted us to think that we were alone if we saw what was happening. And we weren't going to participate in it. Well, you're the only one who thinks like that. And we're not. You know, there's a lot of people out there who saw what was happening and were onto this scam from the very beginning. And I had the help of a person who gave me a heads up about a year before this happened. He said, there's a lot of chatter about Dark Winter 2. And he goes, you know what Dark Winter 1 was? And I was like, yeah, I know about that. And so when I saw all of this, it was falling right in the pattern of all these germ games. The very first one was 2 months before 9/11. So I knew exactly what was happening with this. And also knew about the PCR test and what Carrie Mullis had said. Talk a little bit about what you saw with the PCR.
Right. So that was another part of the Pandora's box that changed right at the beginning of March 2020 when they declared 2 weeks to flatten the curve and change our whole lives upside down.
Mm-hmm. Hey, it's Ben Ferguson, and I want you to pause what you're doing for just 1 minute, and I want you to hear about Alejandra. She lives in a remote community with very few resources and little to no health care. So when Alejandra gets sick, her parents have no real options, no doctors in their community, and no money for real medical care. By the third day, her body was shutting down. She woke up and just long enough to tell her mom, I can't take the pain anymore. I can't keep going. Her parents drove hours to find a doctor who tried everything, but she needed a private hospital, and that was impossible for her family to afford. And that is when Compassion International stepped in. Now, through Compassion, Alejandra was treated, and against all odds, she survived. She lived because someone, just like you, took action. Right now, unfortunately, there are children just like Alejandra who won't survive unless someone like you steps in. Compassion International partners with local churches, providing children with the support that they need, critical medical care, plus food, education, and the hope of the gospel, all in Jesus' name. So help a child just like Alejandra today. You can visit compassion.com. That's compassion.com.
Whether it's slots or live dealers, SpinQuest.com has the fun and action you're looking for. With SpinQuest exclusives, blackjack, roulette, baccarat, and even live dice with craps and bubble craps. The games never stop, so you don't have to. And right now, new users get $30 coin packs for just 10 bucks. Play now at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
I noticed that before COVID, I worked in a university lab when I was in college, and we had what's called a rapid flu test. And it was something that it was a nose swab, too, or it could be a saliva swab. But it wasn't something that went all the way up to your brain like the COVID PCR swab did. And even the instructions, like us in the lab as lab assistants, one of the number one things we did was coach people on how to collect specimens properly, because it was our job to like screen them, make sure they were going to work for the test. And if they weren't in a correct format to accept for the test, then we'd have to tell the nurse or doctor, we need you to go recollect that specimen. So these rapid flu tests, they had to be done within 15 minutes, and it was basically a PCR test. It didn't have the same cycle threshold part, so it was kind of a predecessor to the COVID-19 PCR test. But it wasn't done on every patient that had a cold or flu symptom or a pneumonia at all. It was only done on patients that came in like with a recurrent pneumonia that they couldn't cure or a recurrent cold, and it would be done to try and figure out which types of medications this particular disease would respond to. So it was like a case-by-case basis. It wasn't just everybody that walked into the hospital. And so when COVID-19 came around and they said, you need to stick this all the way up into people's brains, no saliva, and it has to be on every single person. Because, I mean, it really flipped it at one point. It went from, you can't get the PCR test, like, because they had a drive-through where you could go out into society at first, and you have to go to one of these PCR testing centers, and they'd say, you have to have symptoms. Sure. You can't get it unless you have symptoms. And then people were mad that they couldn't get the PCR test. And then, like, overnight, it flipped to now everybody has to get it for everything. You have to get it if you walk in the ER, even if you don't have COVID symptoms. And I thought, that was weird. We never did that before. That is not supposed to be a screening test. It's supposed to be a diagnostic test, because a screen is done when you don't have symptoms. Mm-hmm. It's trying to rule out if you're developing something. Mm-hmm. And they were telling us asymptomatic spread. Well, I could see in the hospital, there's no such thing as asymptomatic spread. This 6 feet thing is made up. Masks don't work. I knew that from the very beginning, because masks in the hospital had only been used for like collecting spittle over like a surgery case. It wasn't meant to like prevent germ spread. That was never part of our our infection control.
Yeah.
So I knew there was something up with these PCR tests, and I kept looking at the results, and finally I find that it's done by PCR. And I recall my time at a university lab when we were just starting PCR testing, because this was early 2000s, and Mullis invented it like late 86 is when the NIH took it up and started using PCR. So it got into healthcare early 2000s, and all the techs, like my mom was a medical technologist, it was her job, she actually ran one of these labs, it was her job to, you know, run those tests, and they were all talking like this was like their new tech, like they were a kid in a candy store excited about it, this PCR thing, but it was all genetic testing, it was genetic, it was done for cancer screening, which they thought was genetic, and it was done for like, women that would, like, they would call it genetic counseling. If you're a couple and you're a female and you go and you want to have genetic counseling, you can see if you have, like, a hereditary disease like Huntington's, and then maybe decide if you want to continue with procreation or not. So it was genetic. So I thought, why all of a sudden are we testing for viruses with PCR? Well, while I wasn't looking, because for 10 years I was a medical coder, so I wasn't really looking at what was going on in the lab until COVID happened. So then I find it's by PCR, and I start looking at, well, there's obviously this problem with false positives. Even Elon Musk was saying, I got two tests in one day, one of them was negative, one of them was positive, and I could see the hospital was running over and over and over these PCR tests, waiting to get a positive result if they didn't get the right result. And I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. What is going on here? And fast forward to like after the PCR test evolved a little bit toward the end of 2020 into 2021, they had what's called a PCR multiplex assay. So it was four different viruses they were actually monitoring. Flu A, flu B, RSV, and COVID-19. And the only one that ever came up positive out of a whole year of running all four of these viruses was COVID. Not one flu, not one RSV. And they say we have a RSV pandemic now.
It's such an amazing thing. And you know, we go back and we used to play the clips all the time of Mullis calling out Fauci because, you know, Fauci used the PCR test to claim that AIDS was caused by a virus. And that created a big back and forth between them. And Mullis said, well, I'm not going to get involved in that fight, but I'll tell you this, that you can't prove it using the PCR test. It can't be used as a diagnostic like that. And so It was very interesting because they also did not isolate the HIV, you know, the virus that supposedly caused AIDS either. And so this whole thing has been kind of a bluff. What it reminds me of, Zoe, is the polygraph tests. My wife used to be a district personnel manager for convenience stores, and what they would do if they would have massive shortages somewhere and they thought there was theft that was going on with the employees, they would call them in and polygraph them. And the polygraph did not work, but it only worked if people believed that it could tell them tell whether or not they were lying, and then they would tell the truth about it and make a confession, right? So it was simply a mind game that was being played on the people that were there. And that's what the PCR thing is. It really is a mind game, except that it's become something of a lie detector for the people who are administering it. We realize now that they are the liars who are putting this stuff out.
Right.
I just had in a comment, Lance put up, my producer, he said that video of Lutnick where he's talking about that reminds him of this scene out of The Big Short, which we just went back and watched again because of the AI bubble. And at one point, this guy gets up and he's talking, and one of the guys who's onto the whole scam says, "Why is he confessing?" And the other guy says, "He's not confessing. He's bragging." And that's basically what Lutnick was doing. He wasn't confessing about all this stuff. He was bragging about it. And how he continues to get away with this kind of stuff. It truly is amazing.
Yeah. Well, what's even more nefarious about the PCR test is, so the false positive narrative, that is only, it's about the cycle threshold, but you're correct. They didn't actually sequence SARS-CoV-2. So they never had a sequence.
Mm-hmm.
They have what's called a consensus sequence, which is an average that an AI came up with.
Yeah.
And that's what they used because they knew they would find this in a percentage of people. And then they could dial it in with the cycle threshold up or down.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with the AIDS thing. They never isolated AIDS, and they used their antibody tests at first, which could be dialed up or down in the same way as the cycle threshold. And David Rasnick, PhD, who I've interviewed, can vouch for that. He's got all the science on his webpage to prove all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was looking past the cycle threshold because I knew this test is dialed in for some reason. Like, they can predict the results somehow. And I needed to know how they were manipulating the test. And so I looked a little bit further and I find a document from the CDC that says for every COVID test, every CLIA certified lab, which is all of them, they all have to be in order to build insurance or anything, have to be CLIA certified. Then they have to send a genetic sequence to one of two gene banks, either NCBI or GISAID gene banks.
Hmm.
And it listed like eight different sequences. So they're saying, you know, the variants in the details.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at some of these labs that were running PCR tests and making all the money off running these PCR tests, they could also take that same sample off that machine, put it on another machine, run a sequence. And they needed to in order to comply with the CDC's directive to send genetic sequences to these gene banks. And I interviewed David Rasnick, who is a chemistry professor who worked with Carrie Mullis and knew Carrie Mullis. I asked him directly, do you think that they were just clipping a tiny little section of the genetic code and then sending it to these gene banks? Or do you think they were getting the entire sequence? And he says, well, they're running a lab. They're busy. They're not really thinking about, you know, taking the time to clip out a sequence. So could they? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But would they really do that? No. It'd be so much easier for them to just send the whole thing and then let the gene bank decide which part that they want to determine is the variant of concern.
Wow.
So they were, and you look at the different gene banks. There's one called Datavant, which is now a public-private partnership. You look at the Human Genome Project, which is now BGI Genetics, I think, in China, which is their biggest biotech company.
Mm-hmm.
And there's billions of dollars in collecting our DNA. And what they say they're using it for is to, and now we have Larry Ellison actually admitting it day two of the Trump administration,
mm-hmm.
that they're going to use AI, which is what they use to get the consensus sequence that they dial the PCR test in with.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to use AI to look at our blood and then make a drug or a therapeutic or a vaccine tailored to our individual genome. And now there's a massive industry of all these big tech oligarchs that are using AI to develop different vaccines or different therapeutics, biotech therapeutics, tailored to the individual genome. So whether or not they're successful with this technology, there's a whole bunch of money invested in it. So I think PCR was actually a data mining operation,
yes,
as well as a money laundering operation.
That's interesting, yeah. And of course, if they want to make a bioweapon that is going to target certain groups of people, that makes it very easy to do that as well. You know, and when you look at the PCR, you know, Handy, who also has a Substack, and he's been a regular listener and commenter on the program. He worked in hospitals, and he said he was suspicious of these things. Finally got a nurse to take one of these swabs right out of the package and run it through and got a positive test without swabbing anybody. So some of these,
yeah,
it was such garbage. I mean, either it's preloaded with something or the PCR test is just so off the charts with its magnification or whatever. You can find anything anywhere. It's Carrie Mullis.
Well, didn't the president of Tanzania, I think he did some PCR tests,
right,
on like a papaya and like a Coca-Cola and got positive results too?
That's right. It's total nonsense and garbage. And I remember when they had the Cannes Film Festival, it was in the summer of 2020, and you had all these elitists who somehow they got there, I guess, on their private jets and didn't have to get screened too much. But anyway, they're there and they were complaining that they had to do spit tests. They said, that's disgusting. We got to spit in this thing and they got to test it and so forth. I said, yeah, so why don't they allow us to do a spit test, right? They got to ram that thing up your nose, but you don't get that. But the elites, the jet setters, the private jets, they get the spit test or whatever.
Oh my God, that's funny.
All this stuff was just
so ridiculous. When I worked in the university lab, there was something called sputum testing, which is exactly that. You basically hawk a loogie into a cup. Mm-hmm. And like it was the most disgusting sample I ever had to deal with when I worked in the lab. And I make a joke in my book. We all were spared that they didn't make that the test that we had to do. But you're telling me that's what the elites do.
Yeah, I think that's preferable to having that thing ramrodded up your nose, I guess. I didn't have that done to me. So I went through the whole thing without having a PCR test. Sorry, go ahead.
Me neither. That was another reason why I walked out, because if I were to stay in the hospital stay working for them and get the exemption, then I was going to have to take a PCR test every week. Mm. And I didn't want to have to take a PCR test. I was pretty sure they were going to be collecting our DNA with it, or sensing if we're vaccinated or not, or somehow tying that in with the vaccine passport. I wasn't entirely sure how it's going to work, but I knew that it wasn't what they were telling us, and I wasn't about to play along.
Yeah.
So that was another reason why I couldn't.
And of course, there were the other things too, where some people did some, you know, zoomed in with a microscope looking at the tip of the swab and said, look at this, you know, here's one of the cotton swab and here's this PCR thing. It's got all these spikes on it. And if I run it across some of these things, those spikes stick and stay. So are they actually implanting something into you? You know,
I did some research on it, and I found there were two chemicals on the tip of the swab. One of them was ethylene oxide, and that alone can, like, they were putting it, you know, way up in your nose, where your pineal gland is, your third eye, which is right at the top.
Mm-hmm.
So putting that chemical right there is known to cause cancer.
Wow.
And so the more you do it, the more carcinogenic it's going to be. And then it also has a chemical property where it will basically block and calcify your pineal gland, so it like closes your third eye, and it's also a way that your brain can sense light. It's how your body basically like synchronizes hormones throughout your whole body, so it can change your whole endocrine system if you close or calcify your pineal gland. So all sorts of things could happen just with that one chemical. But I think there was also graphene oxide on there. There was different schools that said they had been given these special masks even that had graphene in them, similar, like the exact same phenomenon about like, the fibers that actually move and respond to magnetics. Mm-hmm. Well, graphene oxide has a magnetic property to it. That's why they wanted to use it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also supposed to be clean. So they were saying, like, we're using this to make it antibacterial because it has antibacterial properties. but both the swabs and some of the masks had graphene fibers in them that could maybe do that. And
so if they can't inject the graphene,
I have no idea what that would do if you shove it up your nose over and over and over.
So if they can't inject the graphene into you, they can get it in there another way. And, of course, I've mentioned this many times, too. There's a couple of different batches, each of them over a million of these shots in Japan. And they noticed that they were getting black particulates. I don't know if it happened because they didn't keep them at the super cold temperatures or whatever, but they noticed black participants and they particulates, and they said they reacted with magnets. So what is that? But they end of story. No more talking about that. And the Japanese government threw away a couple million of these vaccines because of that type of thing. But yeah, there's just so many issues there, and people have been lied to so thoroughly about all this stuff. This is why it's not a dead issue. It is still alive, and they're going to try to do all this stuff again.
Hey, it's Ben Ferguson, and I want to be honest with you for a second about how an act of compassion really feels. A couple of years ago, I made the choice to partner with an amazing organization called Compassion International. Why? Because I wanted to sponsor a child in need. It was a nice idea, sure, but I had no idea just how much that simple act would change my life as well. I sponsored Nadia and got to watch her life change right in front of my eyes, going from starving literally alone on the streets to getting the health care and education she needs to reach her God-given full potential. I got to be a part of that change, and the light of that compassion not only illuminates in her, it illuminates now in me. That is the power of compassion. The light of Christ shines on all of us. Feel it for yourself and change literally a child's life. Change the world, and you also change yourself. You can sponsor a child today. Visit compassion.com. That's compassion.com.
You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That two-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps, with a live dealer. New players, $30 coin packs are on sale for 10 bucks. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
And since it worked so well, they will use the same tactics again. That's why it's very important to talk about these different tactics. And that's
what
you're
using.
Yes.
Right. They're moving forward with the mRNA. I mean, they're not only putting it in our food. Like we've probably heard, I'm sure your audience has heard about the bird flu and how they're doing the self-amplifying bird flu injections for poultry. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to get it in cattle. And they've had mRNA shots in pork. So almost all the pork is tainted now since like 2018. Mm-hmm. Now they're rolling it out for pets. So now when you go in, you try it and you have to get your annual rabies shot for your pets. Now that's going to be mRNA. They're moving over to the mRNA platform for all the vaccines.
Yes.
So normies that who might be a little like cautious about COVID-19 because they've heard the rumors by now, most of them, but they haven't heard that now your RSV, your flu, and a lot of even like the childhood vaccines are moving over to this mRNA platform where they get to bypass clinical trials.
Mm-hmm.
So it still hasn't been, this is an experiment that is now being rolled out to all our vaccines under the guise of this is totally fine. This is normal science. We've totally tested this. But it's absolutely not. I mean, they've had
that's right. People need to understand
for like 3 years.
Yeah.
For the first one, we just barely passed the first part of monitoring.
That's right. And people need to understand that the guy who boasted about being the father of the vaccine, first things he did, as you pointed out, Stargate thing with Larry Ellison, where he's talking about, well, we're going to use AI to design, custom design this for your genetics, and then we will deliver it with an mRNA platform. And the person that they put in as the, that they chose to put in at the head of the CDC was Susan Monterez. And that had been what she was working on with, BARDA and with, ARPA-H and these dark bioweapon companies that are part of the government and the military industrial complex and the bioweapon platforms and things like that. That's what. So there's all these different threads that tie this throughout the Trump administration, pushing mRNA for all these various things. And, of course, then Brooke Rollins, who's the agricultural secretary, she decides on her own initiative that she's going to end this mass culling of chickens by authorizing the mRNA bird flu for chickens, and then they authorize it for other livestock as well. It is the signals are all there that this is all still going on, that Trump is right at the epicenter of all this mRNA stuff. And I guess what we could call now the mRNAi, as in AI, artificial intelligence. It's all connected together, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's a giant web. And it is going to be tied to our behavior scores and if we comply, how much we comply with it. Mm-hmm. Looking at, you know, who's monitoring the DNA, where they have to report the PCR results to, who's hiding the adverse effects of the vaccine, putting that all together and looking at, where are they actually, where are we reporting all of these PCR results and where are we reporting the COVID-19 case numbers? And now we actually have a code to report the COVID-19 adverse effects, but it's still not being used. Mm-hmm. So looking at that and trying to figure out where the code was and why we're not able to report it still, I happen to find that every agency involved in monitoring COVID-19 cases and vaccination tracking specifically, because there's so many vaccine registries, it blows your mind. It's tied to national security.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a matter of national security if you participate in this scheme or not.
Yeah, and this is all DARPA, and it's all the military and the intelligence agencies and all of the Dark Winter stuff. They had, you know, Fauci and the former head of the CIA was playing the role of the president during the first germ game of Dark Winter. I mean, it's all the usual suspects that are involved in all this stuff. It really is a bioweapon that is really targeted to the population. And it truly is amazing.
I think they're even going to try and do more data mining, like go even further than PCR testing with the wearables rollout that we're getting now. Mm-hmm. Because the information, like, when I learned that our COVID-19 case numbers, the PCR test, is actually getting reported to foreign countries and our DNA is being data mined and they're able to tell if we've had a vaccine or not, what's our ethnicity, where we are, how much money we make. Like, they're layering all of this information. And during Operation Warp Speed, they had a program called Tiberius, which was used in hospitals. There's different Palantir programs that are used in hospitals to monitor and manage the hospital down to like staffing. There was even a program that was part of Operation Warp Speed called HHS Protect. And the hospitals had to report how many ventilators were in use, how many patients were there. I don't know why my camera just stopped. Hmm. That was weird.
Well, I still have audio.
It literally just, I didn't do anything.
You're back.
It just stopped.
That's good. You're back.
So they had this program that hospitals had to report how many ventilators, how many patients are in the ICU, how much remdesivir we were using, what's our census report, like all kinds of information that even the hospital didn't want to have to report in addition to all the other data mining we were doing. Mm-hmm. And that program was a Palantir program, called Tiberius, which it's used in Gaza, and that's the one that they use to assign risk scores. Well, they use that here already in America during Operation Warp Speed to figure out if you were vaccinated or not, to target different ethnic groups for vaccines, and then to figure out where the countermeasures, as in where did the ventilators need to go? Where did the remdesivir need to go? Mm-hmm. So they've already had these programs in place that are tied into our medical records. And then to hear Larry Ellison say, we're going to use your medical records and your DNA, your personal data, to design stuff directly to you. And then in addition, they say, we're going to put wearables on you. They're going to monitor your body at all times for the purposes of national security. And I don't know how that doesn't send shivers down the spine of every single citizen in this country.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we look at their big data thing. They have to have total information awareness. Remember how everybody was creeped out about that? And yet that is mm-hmm. what this really is, the implementation of this. The big data is looking at everything that you're doing, not just online, but they've got to get it out of cyberspace into physical space with all these other aspects of it. And companies like Palantir, they have been focused on geospatial intelligence and data mining and making all these, drawing all these conclusions about people's politics or religion and so forth based just on even geospatial intelligence. When they get to additional factors like this, they know everything about you. And we're not allowed to know anything about what they do or the results. That's why it really is, at its essence, it is an information war. Because, mm-hmm. you know, it is all the information is flowing in one direction, and they have an insatiable appetite to know everything about everybody. It is part and parcel of their control, this total knowledge about everyone and everything. And now AI, and especially companies like Palantir, have given them the ability to go through and collate this massive amount of data that they've been collecting for some time. Now they can make sense of it because it was so much information they've been collecting on people, they couldn't sort through it with humans. And so now they've got the AI that can sort through this. That is what's so right. concerning about all of this. And
it really is, because when you go on social media and you're fed an algorithm of like which posts do you get to see today, mm-hmm. that's going to be how our whole lives are run.
Yes.
And I don't know how many people I've known complain about their algorithm. Oh, it's triggering me today, or I don't know why my algorithm's all screwed up and it's showing me blah, blah. Well, imagine if that same algorithm is now your government gets to make decisions about if you're a good person or not, and if you get to go out today, or if you get to eat today, or if you get to use your money today.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's all about total control. And, of course, that guy, Lucky Lutnick, Howard Lutnick, who was bragging about how much money he could make knowing that the government was going to just flood cash into these pharmaceutical companies. Now I can go in and I can make money off of that, right? So he's got this insider information. He's the guy that's going to be doing the new public-private version of a CBDC. And once they know all your financial transactions, all the rest, any part of this puzzle would give them pretty much total control over your life. But they've got so many different facets where they are monitoring and collating information about you that it truly is just overwhelming to even try to think about it. But again, it's the ignorance and the darkness that they have fooled everybody with. That's why it's so important what you're doing. And again, the site is thrillkillmedicalcult.com, and you're also on Substack, and people find that at zowe.substack.com. And it's very important for people to use this information, try to wake people up as to what's going on. They've not only hidden stuff from people, but they have, in terms of inoculation, the one thing they've inoculated you against is the truth. And they've inoculated you against questioning what they tell people. And that's why you need to try to wake people up with sites like Zoe's as well. So is there anything else that you would like to hit?
If anyone is interested, I'm going to be doing a memorial for the people that we've lost to hospital protocols and mm-hmm. vaccine injured, including women who may have had a stillbirth or a miscarriage due to the shot.
Oh, yeah.
So if you go to my website, there's a page called Vigil. And if you'd like to submit a name of a loved one, you don't have to tell us anything more. Just the name of a loved one. You could even just put, you know, baby boy or baby girl if you like. And we're going to be lighting a candle in remembrance of your loved ones. So if you like, please go and submit a name, and we will honor your loss.
It's important. We cannot forget what they've done to us, and we cannot forget those that they have killed. That's absolutely vital. Thank you so much for what you do. Again, Zoe Smith. Her website is thrillkillmedicalcult.com, and you can find her on Substack at zoe.substack.com, and she spells Zoe, Z-O-W-E. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll take a quick break, folks, and we will be right back. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
listening to The David Knight Show.
Hear news now at APSRadioNews.com or get the APS Radio app and never miss another story.
Hey, it's Ben Ferguson, and I want you to pause what you're doing for just 1 minute, and I want you to hear about Alejandra. She lives in a remote community with very few resources and little to no health care. So when Alejandra gets sick, her parents have no real options, no doctors in their community, and no money for real medical care. By the third day, her body was shutting down. She woke up and just long enough to tell her mom, "I can't take the pain anymore. I can't keep going." Her parents drove hours to find a doctor who tried everything, but she needed a private hospital, and that was impossible for her family to afford. And that is when Compassion International stepped in. Now, through Compassion, Alejandra was treated, and against all odds, she survived. She lived because someone, just like you, took action. Right now, unfortunately, there are children just like Alejandra who won't survive unless someone like you steps in. Compassion International partners with local churches, providing children with the support that they need. Critical medical care, plus food, education, and the hope of the gospel. All in Jesus' name. So help a child just like Alejandra today. You can visit compassion.com. That's compassion.com.
What's going on, Texas? It's Bluff here. Do you like playing casino-style games like blackjack, baccarat, craps, and slots? Well, SpinQuest.com, that's SpinQuest.com, has over 1,000 games available for you to play from the comfort of your own home. New players get $30 coin packages for only $10 and instant cash prize redemption. Now, what are you doing? Put that barbecue down, quit sweeping those tumbleweeds, and get to playing.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Well, let's take a look at the AI bubble. And, of course, it's kind of interesting. SoftBank, you know, we were just talking about Stargate project with Larry Ellison, and the bank that came in was this Japanese bank called SoftBank. They're very much invested in technology issues. And that was what Trump kicked off his second administration with. Well, SoftBank dumped every single share of NVIDIA, and that had an effect on the entire market, not just on NVIDIA stock. And remember, we talked about Michael Burry, the guy behind
who sussed out Big Short,
who sussed out what was going on in the market, real estate market fraud and bubble. And he focused on shorting NVIDIA as well as Palantir. And so we've had a lot of big players and people who are very professional, very savvy, who are calling bubble. And so NVIDIA went down by 1.5% after SoftBank sold all of their shares. And then, of course, Palantir is also going down. And Palantir was really the biggest bet that Michael Burry of The Big Short put on. It was actually when he did The Big Short of over $1 billion, which is like 80% of his company or his fund or whatever. So 84% of that short was Palantir, and 14% or 16% was the NVIDIA. And somebody put this up, inverse Cramer. So look at Cramer as being a contraindicator of what they should invest in. It said Jim Cramer remains undefeated. And so what they have there is a tweet that he put out as recently as the 29th of October. And he was saying, I'm taking my price target for Palantir from 200 to 250! Exclamation mark. Well, it went from 200 when he said that down to now about maybe 165 or 170. As I said, he remains undefeated, as always being the counter indicator of where things should go. And you know, when I look at all of this hype about AI robots that we got from Elon Musk last week, and so many others, you know, the AI hype, the robotic hype and everything, this is Russia and their robot that they wanted to demonstrate. Again, we always hear about Russian bots, right? They're talking about AI that is putting out narratives on social media. But here's a literal Russian bot. And people's comments about this, it looks like they used a drunk to teach its robot how to walk. See how it's walking there. And watch what happens. Takes another couple of steps, and just like a drunk, it falls down on the side. Watch as it's coming. It's staggering. There it goes down. So let's hope that that is a metaphor for robotics and for AI. Again, as I said last week, a lot of people are looking at this and they said, well, you know, what? How does this end? Well, there's only two or three combinations of this that could go. Either the AI hype and the bubble bursts and takes down the economy big time, or global economy big time, or it is successful and it takes everybody's jobs. And I said, well, there's a third alternative that it is sustained by the governments who use it to control us. And I think that is true of both AI and robotics. I think that the best use case for all this stuff is tyranny and totalitarianism. Well, SoftBank dumped their entire NVIDIA stake, but they're not getting out of AI completely. So it's not a complete pushback against AI. They just decided that they would move from NVIDIA to some other platforms that are still involved in AI. And they had just under $6 billion stake in NVIDIA. And the guy who is the head of SoftBank, his name is Gotu. I guess he's the Gotu guy. If you want some tech capital. I can't say if we're in an AI bubble or not, said Gotu. Adding that the sale was for capital and can be utilized for our financing. So he's not going to say that we're in an AI bubble because he's got some other irons in the fire and he doesn't want to tank this thing.
I can neither confirm nor deny that we are in an AI bubble.
Yeah, but a lot of people have been confirming that. As a matter of fact, Zero Hedge pointed out, said, well, we've had four recent articles that are really must-read. Here's the headlines. The AI bubble watch-out metric has just snapped. AI is now a debt bubble, too, quietly surpassing all banks to become the largest sector in the market. And Sam Altman denying OpenAI needs a government bailout. He just wants massive government subsidies. So, yeah, we do the subsidy so we don't have to do the bailout. So it had an effect, of course, on NVIDIA, but also on a lot of different stocks. The futures slid down as AI jitters return. And yet, no matter how many people come out, no matter how many people who are large and connected come out against this, you still have the bubble continues to inflate. And another company was involved in that as well, CoreWeave. They rent out access to the AI chips, and they had some interesting issues there and setbacks as well. But this article from Free Thought Project is very timely. They said it is time to pay attention. Europe has just eviscerated monetary privacy, and it's going to be coming here to the United States next. They're basically starting down the path of banning all cash, state-run digital money. That's a law that has passed, and it goes live in only 400 days. And so they're going to make it criminal to pay cash for anything over 10,000 euros. But, of course, that level is going to continue to come down. That's why you need to get into physical gold and silver. You got to get out of this system, and that's what they're talking about. They have a lot of different alternatives in this Free Thought Project article. One thing they don't mention, strangely enough, is physical gold and silver. I think that is the simplest, easiest, most direct thing to essentially short the totalitarianism. That's what you need to be doing. Don't short the market. Short the totalitarianism. Go to davidknight.gold. That'll take you to Tony Arterburn's Wise Wolf Gold. Have a good day. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, it's Ben Ferguson, and I want you to pause what you're doing for just 1 minute, and I want you to hear about love, generosity, and compassion. We say those words all the time, and they sound good. They feel good. But here's the truth. Those words don't mean anything unless they turn into action. And right now, not later today, not tomorrow, there's a child in the world who doesn't know if they'll eat, if they'll have a chance to learn, or if there's any hope at all. And while we're all busy, life keeps moving forward, but that child is waiting. This is where you come in. With Compassion International, you have the chance to change a child's future. Not just with words, not with promises, but with real help that provides food, education, and hope through local churches and people already in their community. Put your words into action and join me. Introduce a child to a loving Heavenly Father today at compassion.com. That's compassion.com.
What's going on, Texas? It's Bluff here. Are you sick and tired of going to the rodeo, eating that great Texas barbecue, and sweeping tumbleweeds off your driveway? Well, don't worry. You can take a break now. SpinQuest.com. That's SpinQuest.com is a brand new social casino with over 1,000 games available for you to play from the comfort of your own home. Instant cash prize redemptions, and new players actually get $30 coin packages for only $10. Sign up today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Keith Riegert says that there's only two possibilities for AI. It's either going to collapse the economy if it doesn't work out, or if it does work out, the use case is to take everybody's job and make everybody's jobs obsolete. Not a good prospect if those are the two choices that are there. I think, though, that there is a third choice, and that is that the government, maybe it won't take everybody's jobs, and maybe it won't collapse the economy, because maybe the AI bubble won't burst, but we will live under a dystopian control surveillance grid, because that's what the government will use it for. So there's a third alternative. AI's killer use case, folks, is surveillance and control of us. And that's why the government is going to be so desperate to fund it, whatever it takes. If you want to know why gold and silver and Bitcoin are soaring, it's the debasement of the dollar in order to fund the AI arms race, they said. And of course, energy is the reality factor in all of this. That's where it gets real. And that's one of the reasons why Bill Gates and others are moving back away from the climate MacGuffin. The plandemic MacGuffin gives them all the justification that they need, and they need to have this surveillance control and ID, this control grid that is there. They need to have that, and they need to have artificial intelligence to run that. So they're pulling back from that, because in order to have the AI control structure, they've got to have massive amounts of energy. All right, and joining us now is Dr. Richard Restak, MD, and he is a neuroscientist as well, and he has written a lot of books on the brain, and now this is one at kind of the nexus of our brain and artificial intelligence. So I wanted to get him on because we, as you know, we talk about AI and its impact on society quite a bit. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Restak.
Good. I'm happy to be here. Thank you, David.
You've written so many books, and a best-selling author, and of course people can find this on Amazon. You've written so many books. What is different about the brain? What is different about this one? And why did you write this book?
I wrote this book to announce and to discuss the dangers that are lurking, so to speak, in the 21st century, and are unique to the 21st century, but are having an effect on the brain, and a negative one. So that we really are imperiled by 8 different factors, one of which is the global warming. We have new diseases that are present in the 21st century that are increasing, starting with COVID and moving forward. We have problems, of course, with the global warming, which we'll talk about in more detail, and then the internet, the effect of the internet, the effect of AI, memory, the alteration, the attempt to alter memory, almost to alter our memories of what the past was like. This is an ongoing enterprise by various governments in the world, including our own.
Yeah.
We also have surveillance. The seventh, the surveillance, becoming increasingly a surveillance society. It's almost impossible to not be revealing things about yourself because there's surveillance cameras everywhere. I can give you several examples of that just in my own personal life. And then finally, the eighth one is anxiety. All of these things are creating what I call an existential anxiety. People are being given information, but it's being molded according to the thoughts and the inclinations of people in power.
Yes.
For instance, let's take today's, right out of today's New York Times, on page A7, there's an article called "The Air in New Delhi is Life-Threatening." And it tells the tale of the New York Times reporters who have spread themselves throughout New Delhi from 6 a.m. until late in the evening of a certain day recently. And they measured the particulate matter in the air, and it was anywhere from 10 times to 30 times as great as would be considered minimally normal. Now, on top of that, you have the statement that they state that the government is actually trying to hide this kind of insight to the populace by spraying water and other things like that. It says that they're doing this around the measuring stations. And they're also losing data from the measuring stations during the worst bouts of pollution. So there you have the molding of the facts, either denying them altogether or trying to improve them so people say, oh, well, they measured it down at such and such a measuring station, and it was really not all that high. Well, of course, they were spreading water and other things to try to reduce this. So we've got a capitalist society here in the United States, which has a vested interest in pushing forward certain scientific points of view. So science is being put sort of in the back seat, and there's politicians and other people, all of whom share one thing, capitalistic enterprises in which they're part of or which they are advancing.
And a kind of crony capitalism where they can get protection and subsidies as well. And the control is being taken away from us because, as I was just reporting earlier today, they're working very hard to make sure that state and local governments can't enact any control on artificial intelligence. And that came up in the context of talking about how the manufacturers of tasers, also big manufacturers of police body cams, how they want to wed that to artificial intelligence. And the question is, you know, what could possibly go wrong with that if they identify you, they misidentify you as a dangerous criminal and warn the police about how dangerous you are? They could get people killed.
Yeah. Well, not only that, but all of these efforts set up a sense of anxiety and fear. Yeah. Let me just tell you what happened to me in one morning. Called a cab to go to a medical appointment, and when we started going down the road, I said to the driver, you know, you're not going the most efficient or the quickest way. He said, I know that. He said, but I don't want to go that way because there's speed cameras. I said, well, you know, you're driving very sensibly and you're not speeding and I'm in no hurry, so what's the problem? He said, well, they take pictures of everybody that goes by those cameras because they want to see who's in those photos, in those cars.
Yes.
So I asked him to give me a reference for that, and he got sort of didn't say anything else for the rest of the trip. So when I got down to the medical building, I got in the elevator, it said in this facility there is surveillance, both obvious and hidden. That's interesting. And the third
Santa Claus is watching you now.
This is all one morning. And then when I got up to sign in, I signed the board with an electronic pen, and I didn't see no signature. I saw it. I said, well, it didn't take. She said, oh, it took. But we don't allow it to go on the screen so it could be seen. I said, why is that? She said, well, somebody behind you might see the thing and then remember it and use your signature to forward something somewhere. Well, first of all, there was a sign that said stand 10 feet back. And secondly, there's nobody else behind me. So there's three examples just drawn at random that we're becoming an increasingly surveilled society, which is creating a sense of paranoia and a sense of fear. So the brain has to adjust to these type of things, Dave, and it's very hard to do.
And I think that is calculated. You know, they want to do this, even to the extent, when you talk about these cameras taking everybody's picture, the Flock network that is out there, this corporation that is saying, well, we can do whatever we want because it's in public space, and you know, we're not government, so we can collect this information, and yet they collect it in order to sell it to the government. So it's just one level indirect, but they not only grab your license plate, but they also do a complete profile of your car and all of its idiosyncrasies. Does it have a dent here? Does it have a scrape there? What about a bumper sticker? So that it creates a model of your car. And so they almost have, like, you know, biometric identification of your cars as well as of you. And this is now made possible because of the advances of AI. But this has been something that has been concerning me. I look at things kind of from a libertarian perspective. And this has been concerning me for a long time, the idea that government is using technology many different ways, internet, social media, things like that, to monitor and to manipulate us all the time. And to me, artificial intelligence just puts this on steroids. And so I think there is something to be anxious about if we're going to look at this. We should be concerned about it. Maybe not anxious, but we should be concerned about the goals of people who are putting this kind of stuff together.
So. Hey, it's Ben Ferguson, and I want you to pause what you're doing for just 1 minute, and I want you to hear about love, generosity, and compassion. We say those words all the time, and they sound good. They feel good. But here's the truth. Those words don't mean anything unless they turn into action. And right now, not later today, not tomorrow, there's a child in the world who doesn't know if they'll eat, if they'll have a chance to learn, or if there's any hope at all. And while we're all busy, life keeps moving forward, but that child is waiting. This is where you come in. With Compassion International, you have the chance to change a child's future. Not just with words, not with promises, but with real help that provides food, education, and hope through local churches and people already in their community. Put your words into action and join me. Introduce a child to a loving Heavenly Father today at compassion.com. That's compassion.com.
What's up, baby? It's Bretzky, and I'm here to tell you that SpinQuest.com is giving out free sweeps coins. All you gotta do is purchase a $10 coin pack, and guess what? They're gonna give you the coins from a $30 coin pack. That lets you play all your favorite games like Blackjack, Wanted, Dead or Wild, and we're talking real cash prizes, baby. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Oh, yeah.
Well, there's that, and then there's, if you can manage to change the present, you can manipulate the future.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there's a real way to get it is to get control of the past, as Orwell pointed out.
Yes.
You control the past, you can control the present, and by the implication, control the future. And we're seeing alterations of materials, even government documents, government mm-hmm. films, documentaries, mm-hmm. things like that, are being altered in ways that are not visible, not, I should say, detectable, not
yes.
detectable to the ordinary person. So they get ideas about what the past was like, which are wrong,
mm-hmm.
And are don't show you, as I mentioned in the book, if you were at a dance in 1850 before the Civil War, and it's a film we're watching, let's just say we're watching a film about 1850, and we're seeing people ballroom dancing, all that. And then one of them pulls to the side and pulls out a cell phone. And you say, wait a minute, we didn't have cell phones then. Well, you know, there were a lot of things that were going on now that were not going on in the past.
Yeah.
And it's not to our advantage to try to pretend that they were. They
mm-hmm.
weren't.
Mm-hmm.
We have to understand the past, understand the future. Mm-hmm. And we're not only creating situations that are false, but we're also, like in 1984, Orwell created a character called Commander Ogilvy. He was a war hero. He got all sorts of medals, and it was all the prolets that were all told to honor him and so forth. Well, he never existed. He actually was made up entirely. And that's one of the things that the narrator is doing in the job at work, is filling in photographs, inserting OOV into historical events that happened, wartime scenarios, etc. Anyone reading it will say, wow, this is some man. Well, he was a complete fabrication. We're just about at that point with Sora out, yeah. The AI out, which could take you and had you, to say, let's get the David Knight and have him leading some sort of a parade of whatever. And, suddenly people say, well, gosh, I saw him with my own eyes. So what's happening is that the actual seeing is believing is being turned on its head. So that's no longer true.
You're talking about a completely fabricated character out of Orwell. Just recently they had Tilly Norwood, who is a completely fabricated AI personality. And the person who came up with it is... got agents representing her. They got her out there as an actress.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's like, so I've created an AI actress, which will do a lot of different roles for you. She probably does her own stunts as well, I imagine. But people in SAG, the Screen Actors Guild, and they're furious about this. And said, any agent that represents this AI character is not going to do any business with us. But we're already at that point. It truly is interesting.
And one of the ways of neutralizing it is to create the situation that exists right now between you and me. You're laughing, and I'm laughing because it seems funny. Mm-hmm. And it is funny. Mm-hmm. But it's a very serious purpose behind all this.
Yes.
It's all a matter to try to alter people's perceptions so that they begin to doubt the validity of what they're seeing.
That's right. Yes. And I've talked for the longest time about how the whole idea for the internet was created by DARPA psychologists. And I've been concerned that it was all about psychological manipulation from the get-go with all of this. But as a physician and as a neuroscientist, I'd be interested in your take on, what is currently going on. Because besides manipulating the past by changing information about the past or, memory holding it or writing a new alternative history of it, they're also concerned, and there's been projects that have been put out by DARPA, and I don't know if they've been successful or not, but they're putting out requests for people to come up with things to manipulate people's memories. So you've got a soldier, they say, who's got bad PTSD. Let's get rid of that memory. Let's give them different memories. What do you see in terms of someone who studies the brain and neuroscience? What do you see about that? What do you think is the state of the art with that?
Well, my last book was called The Complete Book of Memory. It had to do with memory. I studied memory in great detail. And, of course, you have to do away with the concept that memory is like a videotape or something that you just store in your brain, and when you want to get it, you just bring it out like you'd bring out a videotape. Mm-hmm. It's not like that. It's a reconstruction. Each time you think back to a certain event, you alter that memory so that you have memory one, memory two, memory three, on and on and on. That's the nature of memory. Hmm. And memory can be manipulated. It's always, like in the courtroom, mm-hmm. they're always trying to avoid the contamination of the witness. Hmm. An example of that would be, well, which car went through the red light? And to ask a witness, and he said, oh, it was the red car went through the red light. Well, would it surprise you to know that it wasn't a red light, but it was a stop sign, Mr. Witness? And of course, his credibility is gone.
Yeah.
Because he took the suggestion that it was a red light instead. Mm-hmm. And it would be very easy to do because you don't necessarily have that image of that intersection in your mind. So that's why there's protections even in the courtroom against leading the witness, they call it. Mm-hmm. In other words, providing information that's either not true at all or half true. So we've got that going. This didn't start in the 21st century. That started, as long as we've had courtrooms.
Right.
This is more an emphasis now on altering memory is the people will get up there, and under cross-examination, they'll do pretty well because their whole memory's been altered. They've changed it by various mechanisms, suggestion, repeating information, which is false, of course, which is the misinformation. Mm-hmm. There was a cartoon about a week ago by Ramirez in which he's a Pulitzer Prize winner. He has three doctors in an operating room, in a laboratory. So one of them is looking into a microscope, and he looks up and he says, "This is the most dangerous pathogen we have ever encountered." And the second doctor says, "Well, is it bubonic plague? Is it smallpox?" And then the one, he says, "No, it's misinformation and disinformation."
That's right. And we got to be very careful, because many times the people who will tell us about that are the people who want to be the ones who define what the information is for us. And they will ask those leading questions. You know, when we're talking about leading questions and manipulating people, there's been a lot of reports about artificial intelligence, people who have a particular psychosis or something, and they get involved with the AI, and it starts to confirm the things that they want, because that's what it is set up to do in terms of bias. They want to be empathetic and sympathetic to people. And so it starts doing that and leading them further and further down a particular rabbit hole. There's been situations of, people who got into severe mental distress, some suicides of some young children and other things like that. Speak to that aspect of it and the real danger of that. That is really kind of, I think, speaks to the psychological aspect and potential of artificial intelligence. And that could be weaponized. Right now it's just kind of happening out of their business model, right? But that could definitely be weaponized against people.
Well, I talk about that in my book, in the chapter on the Internet. There are famous examples of people who have suicided right on the Internet, live feed, and they've been manipulated to doing that by other people who've encourage them, said this would be a sign of strength, this would be a sign of that you're not afraid to die if necessary. And there's cases of it that actually led to the suicide. One of them is the most grisly I have in my book, about a person who was talked into pouring gasoline over themselves and setting a match, all on open feed, Internet, and while this fire is burning, you can hear...
Hey, it's Ben Ferguson, and I want you to pause what you're doing for just 1 minute, and I want you to hear about Alejandra. She lives in a remote community with very few resources and little to no health care. So when Alejandra gets sick, her parents have no real options, no doctors in their community, and no money for real medical care. By the third day, her body was shutting down. She woke up and just long enough to tell her mom, "I can't take the pain anymore. I can't keep going." Her parents drove hours to find a doctor who tried everything, but she needed a private hospital, and that was impossible for her family to afford. And that is when Compassion International stepped in. Now, through Compassion, Alejandra was treated, and against all odds, she survived. She lived because someone, just like you, took action. Right now, unfortunately, there are children just like Alejandra who won't survive unless someone like you steps in. Compassion International partners with local churches, providing children with the support that they need, critical medical care, plus food, education, and the hope of the gospel, all in Jesus' name. So help a child just like Alejandra today. You can visit compassion.com. That's compassion.com.
What's going on, Texas? It's Bluff here. Are you sick and tired of going to the rodeo, eating that great Texas barbecue, and sweeping tumbleweeds off your driveway? Well, don't worry. You can take a break now. SpinQuest.com. That's SpinQuest.com is a brand new social casino with over 1,000 games available for you to play from the comfort of your own home. Instant cash prize redemptions, and new players actually get $30 coin packages for only $10. Sign up today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Everybody in the background's cheering. We did it. We did it. We got him to do it.
Wow. That's amazing.
So there's something about the Internet and about that actually brings out sadistic, criminal, psychopathic trends, and we don't know why. Is the fact that you don't necessarily can't be identified, but it's something that is going to be influencing and has influenced the internet greatly, and it will continue to do so until we understand it.
I think that's one of the things that's so dangerous about the things that we saw with lockdown and other aspects of it. There's an atomization here, and so many different ways the government and tech companies are trying to make sure that we're not in person with each other. You know, many cases, like for example, this interview, we couldn't do this interview if both of us had to travel. We're able to do this because we can do it over Zoom or whatever. Just taking ordinary things that you would normally do in terms of interacting with people in school or in church or in your community or whatever, taking that away and putting a screen between the two of you, it really does change the way people interact with each other. I remember Errol Morris, the film director, was able to get people to say all kinds of things to him. He got a murderer to confess. He got Robert McNamara to confess to about the false flag of the Vietnam War. He got people to say all kinds of stuff because there was that distance between him and them. He could have interviewed them in person, but what he did was he put an Interatron, which is what he called it. It was basically a teleprompter that he had set up so he could do two-way communication at the time. And once he had that distance there, then it completely changed the dynamics that he would have versus with somebody person to person. And that's what we're talking about here, isn't it?
Yeah, we're talking about that. And, of course, there's gradations of this, and it continues. Like you're interviewing me, we're discussing. I feel like it's a discussion. If I were to say something that later I regretted, I could probably say, oh, well, that wasn't me. That was my avatar.
Or my agent, right? Yeah. I got an AI agent that's out there doing stuff.
My publicist.
That's right. It's crazy. We also see, though, as a doctor, you're seeing people have noticed actual physical changes that can be observed in people's brains. I'm thinking of the story about the London taxi drivers who would do the knowledge, and they would find that after they memorized all these factual details and drew on that all the time, in order to take people to, this very complicated city with its complicated streets, that they had a particular part of their brain that was larger than the typical person. And then they found that once they stopped doing that, it started to shrink again. And we're starting to see that happening with people in a lot of different areas of their life, that kind of atrophy. And it's physically observable, isn't it?
Well, it is. You have to learn. You have to use the things that you have learned to do. Like I mentioned in my memory book, there's all kinds of memory exercises that you can do. I do them every day, and they're very easy, and they help you to continue with your memory, and to keep it sharp.
Give us some examples. I'm sure everybody would love to know that. We'd all like to have a better memory. What kind of things can we do to exercise?
Well, think about the fact that you never had to learn pictures when you were an infant, and a young child. A picture was something that you could. You know, you may not know what you're looking at, but you could see it without an intermediary. Whereas language is something that you have to hear from other people. It's something that's sort of added on to the brain, okay? As a result, the best way of remembering something is to make an image for it, okay? For instance, I have a little dog called a Skipper Key. Skipper Key is a Belgian dog. He's a nice little fellow. But it was embarrassing to me when walking the street, people would say, what kind of a dog is that? And I couldn't come up with a name because it was such so complicated. And I thought, that's Skipper Key. I didn't speak any Dutch or anything. So then I got this image of a small boat with a large captain with a beard holding a big key. So it was Skipper Key. Mm-hmm. And I remember it forever. So I had the picture. Once I have the picture, it's easy to do. An easy way to do it, and you can do that with all kinds of times, all the time. I was going upstairs before I came down to the office, and I wanted to get my wallet, and I wanted to get my cell phone. So I just had an image of a wallet in the form of a cell phone, and I was walking up the stairs talking into the wallet cell phone. So I got up, and I knew I had these two elements to get. be very easy to get one and forget the other. So that you have these images all the time. And the quickest, you know, this is sort of off the topic of the book, but if you want to have a firepower memory for a load of things, that's up to 10 things, and get 10 areas that you are familiar with, that you see every day, and then you could put on those images the thing you're trying to remember. So if I'm trying to remember a loaf of bread, milk, maybe a batteries, I have a regular way of doing that. I have, like, I remember the library that's near my home, the coffee shop, liquor store, Georgetown University Medical School where I went, Georgetown University, Cafe Milano, which is a place in Washington everybody gathers, and then Key Bridge, Iwo Jima Memorial, and Reagan Airport. So that bread would be, for instance, the loaf of bread. I would look in the window of the library. Instead of seeing books, I'd see bread, loaves of bread. And when I get down to the liquor store, instead of it being filled with liquor, it'd all be milk bottles. So that's how I'd get to it. So I have those 10, so I can get 10 items together without any problems at all.
That's great. It's interesting you talk about the importance of a visualization. It's one of the things that I do in terms of preparing for the show. I have a lot of articles that I go through, and it's really when I highlight things or when I write them down, that's when I can remember them. If I don't do that, if I were just to read these things, I wouldn't remember them. But if I interact with it and write it down, that helps me to remember it. So that is a kind of visualization there, I guess, as well. It truly is interesting. And what you said earlier about memory not being something that is stored in a place, as somebody coming from a computer science background, that was a very different thing. When you construct your memory, how do you reconstruct that? I mean, that opens up a whole new area of questions as well. In other words, if every time somebody brings up a subject, I mean, there isn't something that's stored initially to reference that and then rebuild from that.
There's the interconnections. Like, you know, somebody listening to us might say, well, gee, this is called the 21st century brain, but I haven't heard that much about the brain. Well, let me just link that up so that these things make sense. We have a new version, or I should say a new understanding of the brain called the connectomic brain, in which there's all kinds of interactions in the brain of parts of the brain, which we're just learning about. I have I use the metaphor of a bowl of spaghetti. You pull out one of the strains of spaghetti and you never have any idea what it's connected to, how many other strains of spaghetti this is connected to. So that's, if you think of the brain as being kind of set to make connections, that's its natural processing. So it gets back to these things that we were talking about earlier. You know, global warming and memory and surveillance and all that. How are we going to solve all those? Well, somehow or other, those things are connected with each other. That's the take-home message of this book. And the basic goal is to try to figure out what it is that connects these things, what it is that would allow us to by solving one of them, solve the other.
Hey, it's Ben Ferguson, and I want you to pause what you're doing for just 1 minute, and I want you to hear about Alejandra. She lives in a remote community with very few resources and little to no health care. So when Alejandra gets sick, her parents have no real options, no doctors in their community, and no money for real medical care. By the third day, her body was shutting down. She woke up and just long enough to tell her mom, "I can't take the pain anymore. I can't keep going." Her parents drove hours to find a doctor who tried everything, but she needed a private hospital, and that was impossible for her family to afford. And that is when Compassion International stepped in. Now, through Compassion, Alejandra was treated, and against all odds, she survived. She lived because someone, just like you, took action. Right now, unfortunately, there are children just like Alejandra who won't survive unless someone like you steps in. Compassion International partners with local churches, providing children with the support that they need, critical medical care, plus food, education, and the hope of the gospel, all in Jesus' name. So help a child just like Alejandra today. You can visit compassion.com. That's compassion.com.
Whether it's slots or live dealers, SpinQuest.com has the fun and action you're looking for with SpinQuest exclusives, blackjack, roulette, baccarat, and even live dice with craps and bubble craps. The games never stop, so you don't have to. And right now, new users get $30 coin packs for just $10. Play now at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Mm-hmm. And I mentioned at the end of the book, experts so far haven't done it. So it's useful, as Hayek said, to get ordinary people to give, when I say ordinary, I mean non-specialized people, to give their ideas. Gee, I wonder what such and such would happen. What would happen about global warming? For a while there was, in fact, there's still experiments going on the effect of sulfur that would help the CO2 problem. And, you know, shooting sulfur up into the atmosphere. And of course, the reason for that was the volcano in 1980-something, in which after that volcano in Hawaii, it was noted that the air was clearer and there was less pollution. So that's something to think about. Is there some way of using that particular sulfur experiment to decrease global warming? Mm-hmm. War, for instance, we don't think of war as a cause of global warming, but it is.
Oh,
more
yeah.
CO2.
Thermonuclear warming.
It's been put up since the Ukraine war and the Gaza war. Then, you know, a tremendous amount that's going to overcome and exceed the benefit of any of these things like, you know, non-gasoline engines, but using electric fuel and things like that.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, shooting up rockets in order to put satellites up. You know, how many cars and lifetime use of cars from people would that be equivalent to? And you start talking about all the missiles that are being shot, and then you get to the explosives as well. It is really interesting how they focus us on their objectives for their ways to control us. The manipulation's been going on for quite some time. It is pretty amazing. And I guess that's when you look at this stuff, it really does look like science fiction. And I'm almost inclined to write it off when I first see it. When DARPA is saying, well, we need to find some way that we can, erase memories in people and insert new memories into them. I mean, we're going back to Total Recall, right? So it sounds like something from a Philip K. Dick novel, but they're really working on that. And I guess one of the most striking things that we saw, we reported on a couple of weeks ago, and it was a company that was bragging about how they could read your mind more accurately and quickly than their competitors, because there's a lot of different companies that are doing this. And how they could, it was called Brain IT was the name of the company. And so they had a way that they would do MRI, and they could essentially train it on your brain in a much shorter period of time than the other people. And they could get much better results. And our producers just pulled this up. So what they do is they show you an image, and you're looking at that image, and then it's reading your mind and reconstructing what you're looking at. Which I thought was absolutely amazing and terrifying at the same time. How is this going to be used? I guess that's the real issue. When we start talking about all these different things, I think that is the real case, that it's difficult for people to understand just how far and how quickly the technology has progressed. And then to say, and how do we control this from it being used for bad purposes?
Well, that's a specifically 21st century problem.
Yes.
Because all of these things have either originated in the 21st century, or they have in fact further developed and become increasingly threatening. And bear in mind, we have to solve these problems, because they're not something that's going to go away. And then the most important thing to remember, David, is that all of these things harm the brain, and the brain is the thinking processor that's mm-hmm. going to save us, mm-hmm. that's going to figure out what the problems, what the solutions to the problems are. Mm-hmm. So we know now that wildfire smoke, for instance, it creates dementia. It enhances the likelihood of somebody becoming demented. So as the brain is affected negatively, increasingly over longer and longer periods of time, our ability to solve these problems is going to decrease. So mm-hmm. we've got to do it now. We've got mm-hmm. to get serious about it. And this business of people getting up and saying the global warming is fiction and all that is really very, very disturbing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, the example that you gave earlier of the fact that the Indian government was manipulating the temperature at some of the stations there, that kind of works both ways. They have put some of these temperature stations on the airport tarmacs, and in the UK, they have a lot of the temperature stations that they've got there, they're just extrapolating the data. They don't have real temperature measurement stations there. So it all really gets back, I think, to the scientific method. And that's really where we have to hold people's feet to the fire. When we're talking about something like that, we can have an absolute standard of what truth is. And that truth is going to be being able to measure something accurately and being able to reproduce that. And then I think a good yardstick for that is when somebody is trying to hide their data, that's the clue right there that they're not doing science, because if they're doing science and they've come to the right conclusion, they don't have a problem with somebody looking at their data. So I've got a question here for you from a person in the audience asking if you know about Drs. James Giordano and Charles Morgan and their work with military. I'm not familiar with those names. I don't know if you know anything about that or not.
The Giordano sounds familiar. What particular thing are they asking about them?
I don't know. It just says their work with military. I guess it would have to do with something, but you haven't heard of it.
I could say Giordano did this or did that. No.
Sure, I understand. Let's talk a little bit about the things that we have been anxious about. And, of course, as Christians, we have one answer to it. But you talk about how this is something that has been, you know, around pretty much all of our life. I mean, I grew up with anxiety about nuclear war, for example. That was on everybody's television, and that was forefront of our mind, especially growing up in Florida. When the Cuban Missile Crisis was happening, they got us really afraid of that when I was in elementary school. You know, it's like, there's not going to be enough time for you to get home, you know, when the nuclear bombs start falling. And so, I mean, there's all these different ways that you can panic people. I guess part of it is, how do we identify the real problems and how do we deal with those problems? Because there's always things that are competing for our attention and our anxiety, many of which are not real, you know, and usually the things that you're really the most concerned about don't happen. And it may be sometimes because you have taken a precaution about it. What would you say about that, about anxiety?
You're starting to break up a little bit. Can you hear me clearly?
I hear you. Yes. Sorry about that. You talk
it's
about
breaking up a little bit.
You're talking about traumatizing a population. You know, what do we do to guard against that type of thing? And of course, that's going to really escalate with the ability of AI to create a narrative.
Yeah, well, let's talk about it as an avenue to get into that. Let's go back to what you brought about the atomic weapons and the mm-hmm. atomic war and the fears of the people that there's going to be another atomic war. I mean, you know, this is not unrealistic. There's even been a movie that's just come out that's getting all kinds of attention, as you know, mm-hmm. and it has to do with the threat of a nuclear war. Things in if you look at what's happening in the Europe right now, mm-hmm. there's all kinds of suggestions that it could lead to a nuclear war. I mean, Ukraine now has announced that they're under no conditions willing to give up any land, and mm-hmm. Stalin is. Putin is thinking what he can do to change that. Maybe he'll attack another country. I mean, this is scary stuff. So what's happening in response to the government is to try to show that, we shouldn't worry about it. We have things under control, but I don't think things are under control.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you know, we've talked about the problems, and we talk about problems all the time. You have your final chapter is New Ways of Thinking. And I'd like to talk about that. One of the things that you say is Occam was wrong, Occam's razor, that you know, people are familiar with. Tell us a little bit about that. Why is Occam wrong?
Well, because he says that, you know, the entities are not to be multiplied, meaning that we can always explain things best by limiting ourselves to the minimum amount of factors, ideally.
Hey, it's Ben Ferguson, and I want you to pause what you're doing for just 1 minute, and I want you to hear about Alejandra. She lives in a remote community with very few resources and little to no health care. So when Alejandra gets sick, her parents have no real options, no doctors in their community, and no money for real medical care. By the third day, her body was shutting down. She woke up and just long enough to tell her mom, "I can't take the pain anymore. I can't keep going." Her parents drove hours to find a doctor who tried everything, but she needed a private hospital, and that was impossible for her family to afford. And that is when Compassion International stepped in. Now, through Compassion, Alejandra was treated, and against all odds, she survived. She lived because someone, just like you, took action. Right now, unfortunately, there are children just like Alejandra who won't survive unless someone like you steps in. Compassion International partners with local churches, providing children with the support that they need, critical medical care, plus food, education, and the hope of the gospel, all in Jesus' name. So help a child just like Alejandra today. You can visit compassion.com. That's compassion.com.
What's going on, Texas? It's Bluff here. Are you sick and tired of going to the rodeo, eating that great Texas barbecue, and sweeping tumbleweeds off your driveway? Well, don't worry. You can take a break now. SpinQuest.com. That's SpinQuest.com is a brand new social casino with over 1,000 games available for you to play from the comfort of your own home. Instant cash prize redemptions, and new players actually get $30 coin packages for only $10. Sign up today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
One cause of every effect. That's not true. It's certainly not true in the 21st century, where there's all kinds of interactions between factors and causes. So that Occam was wrong in that basis. We have to think of an interconnecting pool, just as in the brain, of interconnections of neurons, interconnections of these problems, and they're all related. They're all related. All eight of them that I talk about in my book, they're all related. And if you can figure a way of influencing one, you influence all the others. I mean, who would think there'd be a connection between global warming and the amount of artisan and cheese, for instance, high-end cheese? Well, there is, because chickens don't lay many eggs, and there'd be all the various other things that come on in terms of making cheese. I learned that the other day. That was something that was a surprise to me.
You know, it's kind of interesting when we talk about connections so much. There was a series that was on, I think it was on PBS. I think the guy's name was Burke. I can't remember his first name. I'm not sure about the last name. But he had a series called Connections. And yes. I thought it was fascinating, because what he would do is he would take a whole series of connections to show how a particular technology had evolved. You know, so he might go from, you know, the quill to the jet engine or something like that. And it was a fascinating, fascinating thread of things, very much like what you're talking about.
It really is. And I did consult his work, actually.
Did you?
When I was writing this book, because he did that connections. He did a book called The Day the World Changed and all this. He also did a book called Circles, in which he would start with one particular event that occurred in history. And if you go around the circle, you come back to the beginning where it started, where this particular inventor invented something. What led up to it? What was the circle leading to that? Mm-hmm. So yes, we're talking about connections, and we're talking about the inability to understand things without reference to supporting and accessory factors. We have that going on all the time, denying things that are going to be happening. Mm-hmm. And of course, I think the fearful thing is that the government is aiding in this denial.
Yes.
Because if you deny that there's a problem, then there's very little impetus to try to solve it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah,
if there ain't no problem, don't try to solve it.
They're throwing out their own chaos and uncertainty and anxiety that's out there all the time, always, I guess. So the question is, you're talking about volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity. I mean, that sounds like a government policy. I think they've got bureaucracies that specialize in that.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's true.
Yeah, that's in your section there about new ways of thinking. And so how do we incorporate that into new ways of thinking that help us to solve this riddle?
Well, each of those factors is a factor that helps you to understand things and to have more control. It doesn't necessarily mean it helps you to link them together. That has to be done by original thinking, by you have to be, you know, under those things, things are volatile. You don't have a basic a situation that doesn't change. It changes all the time. So that the other thing that I want to emphasize the most is that is the role of capitalism in all of this. I mean, there's all this, like the private equity, the business of people having a point of view that is going to advance them financially, and that blinding them to the problems that are here. Like, for instance, we talked about global warming. Well, the rich people, the very rich people, are buying multi-million dollar apartments and condominiums which have special air filters which will keep the wildfire smoke out and will try to keep the global warming effect at bay by superpower air conditioners.
So of course, they're building their own bunkers too.
they're building things that are
creating all kinds of chaos and weapons of war, mass destruction. They're out there building super bunkers in various places as well. So I think they're somewhat pessimistic about what they're doing.
Well, it's basically the idea is that, you know, we don't care about the ordinary person.
Yeah.
We're going to survive. We're going to see to our own survival. And in order to do that, we have to deny certain things that are going on will do so. Now, incidentally, all of this is not conscious thinking. They don't necessarily say, well, I'm going to deny global warming because it'll be to my advantage financially because all my investment is in the oil and gas industry. They don't do it that way. They come up with pseudo logic, things that seem to make sense to them. But if they didn't have a financial thrust in the matter, they would look upon it quite differently.
That's right. We can always find a justification for what it is that we really want. Everybody should understand that if you're a parent this time of year at Christmas time, you can always understand that people will come up with a justification for what they want. And that's as true of government as it is of corporations out there. And it's really dangerous when the two of them connect with each other. I think that's one of the things, you know, you talk about connections and the importance of it and how we can try to connect these different factors, each of us individually, but I think it's the human connection that is out there that is going to be essential for all of this. It's going to be our collective work on all this. What do you think about that? Would you agree with that?
Well, I'd agree with it, but there's so many things that are taking place now that are causing the schisms and splitting people into factors and belief systems and political points of view that are. And that's very dangerous because then you can't get together any kind of unity, even in the face of an emergency.
Well, I think we've always had these factions and things like that. You know, the founders of the country warned about factions and political parties. But I think what makes it unique is that when you're interacting with people on a personal basis, you interact with them a little bit differently than if you've got that separation between you that technology is giving us now. Because now you're interacting with something that's abstract. It's not with another person. And there's also the body language that you're not picking up on. But it makes it easier for you to be harder on people when there's that distance there, I think. That's why I think, you know, the personal connection, I think, is really vital to making these connections and coming up with an understanding of what's going on. We talk about the hidden factors that are out there, hidden unrelated topics. Other people, as you pointed out earlier, just talking to ordinary people about what it is that you see with different things. I think that is the genius of the collective free market out there, that there's so many observers who are looking at things and thinking about them, and it's kind of their collective decision that is kind of guiding things along. as opposed to having a central planner who's doing that. What do you think about that? In your final chapter, A New Way of Thinking, you have what you call a sensible solution. What does that really involve?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said. What's the last part?
You have a sensible solution. What do you think a sensible solution to the kind of stress and chaos and anxiety that we have, manipulation that we have? What is the solution to that?
Well, I think the Wikipedia is a good example of that. They have people from all walks of life, all levels of education, free to contribute to whatever topic they may want to do that. It may be helpful. I mentioned earlier about the effect of global warming on making of cheese. Mm-hmm. There might be somebody who makes cheese that's going to come up with some idea. You know, we don't know that. We mm-hmm. don't know that that may not be where comes some original idea about what to do about global warming. And you put it on what I'd like to think, and I hope it will be developed, a kind of Wikipedia, mm-hmm. where the ordinary person can feel free to put forth their ideas about it. Now, you say, well, we already have that. We have the Internet. No, we don't. The Internet is a commercial situation. It's all done for making money and grab attention and all that. And there's no criticism of it. There's no peer review, if you will. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the Wikipedia, I mean, you know, people could write in and say, well, that particular contribution is bonkers, and then give an example why it is, or that was a very good idea. And after that, you begin to get things coming together mm-hmm. in unpredictable ways that may help us solve these eight problems.
Mm-hmm. Hey, it's Ben Ferguson, and I want you to pause what you're doing for just 1 minute, and I want you to hear about love, generosity, and compassion. We say those words all the time, and they sound good. They feel good. But here's the truth. Those words don't mean anything unless they turn into action. And right now, not later today, not tomorrow, there's a child in the world who doesn't know if they'll eat, if they'll have a chance to learn, or if there's any hope at all. And while we're all busy, life keeps moving forward. But that child is waiting. This is where you come in. With Compassion International, you have the chance to change a child's future. Not just with words, not with promises, but with real help that provides food, education, and hope through local churches and people already in their community. Put your words into action and join me. Introduce a child to a loving Heavenly Father today at compassion.com. That's compassion.com.
You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That two-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite spots, live blackjack, live craps, with a live dealer. New players' $30 coin packs are on sale for 10 bucks. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hmm. Yeah, the problem is it seems like whenever you wind up having a forum or a place where things can be, and that's true of the Internet, it's also true of Wikipedia, then it becomes you have gatekeepers who are there. And we saw this in spades throughout the COVID stuff, that if somebody's got a different idea, rather than debate them, the impetus is to silence them by the people who are in authority. And so that really, I think, is the key thing. And I think as part of that, we see a continuing rise in disgust and deprivation of free speech. People are not interested in the principle of free speech. They don't want to have open debate. And I see this, regardless of where people are coming from on the political spectrum, there is a declining interest in debate and thinking. You know, the debate is critical to critical thinking. And so the people who are in charge, the gatekeepers, whether it's Wikipedia or the Internet or, you know, any other form of information, they are weighing in on that, and they don't want things that they disagree with. And it might be because they've got an agenda, or it might be because they've just got a particular prejudice about something. They want to make sure that the contrary views don't get out there. That I think, is a real key that's there. And again, this is part of this atomization that we have of people, feeding that tribalism in a way that we've never seen it before. using technology.
I would agree with everything you've just said, exactly. And I think we have to try to get beyond that. But we get back again to this business of people having their own personal financial point of view and position and pushing that basically on the fact that they look upon it as. So maybe we're talking about a capitalism problem. Mm. We've got capitalism. That's what this country's all about. But, I mean, it's in certain parts of it now. We've gotten to the point where people are unable to take another point of view if it's going to be financially harmful and hurtful to them.
Yeah. I think that, you know, we start looking at the tech companies. I don't think that their capitalism would exist. I don't think they'd have billions of dollars if they weren't unified with the government. So there's a symbiosis there that the two of these entities feed off of each other. And I think that's right. That nexus right there is the difficult thing. And so I think, you know, when I think of capitalism, I don't like to refer to capitalism anymore, because I think of it as a partnership, a public-private partnership, some kind of a economic fascism where they are working together. But I like to think of a free competitive market where the government doesn't have any role except as some kind of a referee between two parties that have a conflict or something. But yeah, that's the thing that's really driving this. You know, many people, when they talk about AI, they said, well, you know, here's a couple of different outcomes. Maybe this stuff really works the way it's supposed to work and it takes everybody's jobs and we wind up with a depression. Or maybe it doesn't work at all, in which case the big AI stock bubble that we've got bursts and everybody loses their job because of that. And so, well, there's a third alternative, and that is that the government keeps propping it up with public funds because it feeds their surveillance and manipulation needs, their ability to surveil and to control us. And I really think that that's where this is all going to head. I don't really, you know, those other two things may happen and they may be true, but I think there is a customer out there for the AI stuff that is driving all this stuff, that has been putting out these proposals for the longest time. And that's governments around the world. I mean, we look at the Brain Project that we had a few years ago. That was during the Obama administration. But things like the brain-computer interface that Elon Musk and many other tech companies are doing out there, there's Neuralink, and there's a lot of them that are doing that. That's being driven by the government wanting to connect into our minds, hack into our minds, really. And they've been funding that kind of right. stuff. So how do we break that? Yeah.
On the Musk side, he's doing it for money. I mean, obviously to make money.
That's right.
So that there's an unholy alliance, if you will, between someone who can't see anything other than the dollar, and another side, the government can't see anything other than increasing power and surveillance over the population.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely true. Well, it's a fascinating book. It's a fascinating take on this. And of course, you've written many books on the brain. The memory one, very interesting. And you do have sections about memory in this book as well. And people will be able to find this on Amazon, I guess, is the best place that they can find it. Looking for the title of this. And it is... you know, it is something that I think we all need to think about how we're going to operate the effects that this technology is having on our brains in the 21st century. And that is the title of the book, The 21st Century Brain, by Richard Restack. Thank you very much, Dr. Restack. Thank you. Appreciate you coming on.
Good, David. I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Yeah, very interesting conversation. Thank you. Have a good day. Folks, we're going to take a quick break, and we will be right back. Thank you.
Hey, it's Ben Ferguson, and I want to be honest with you for a second about how an act of compassion really feels. A couple of years ago, I made the choice to partner with an amazing organization called Compassion International. Why? Because I wanted to sponsor a child in need. It was a nice idea, sure, but I had no idea just how much that simple act would change my life as well. I sponsored Nadia and got to watch her life change right in front of my eyes, going from starving literally alone on the streets to getting the health care and education she needs to reach her God-given full potential. I got to be a part of that change, and the light of that compassion not only illuminates in her, it illuminates now in me. That is the power of compassion. The light of Christ shines on all of us. Feel it for yourself and change literally a child's life. Change the world, and you also change yourself. You can sponsor a child today. Visit compassion.com. That's compassion.com.
You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That two-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps, with a live dealer. New players' $30 coin packs are on sale for 10 bucks. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
All right, welcome back, and joining us now is Wayne Morrow. He is the CEO of the John Birch Society, and he's got something I think is very interesting to talk about, and that is Fabian socialism. You probably heard this term before, but maybe you don't understand what it is or the difference between it and the Marx and Karl Marx's approach and how much more dangerous it is. You know, for me growing up, Fabian was a teen idol. And I saw Fabian socialism. It's like, you know, what is that? You know, but actually, it's a famous Roman general, and Fabian's parents were Italian, and I guess maybe that was the namesake, or they might have been socialist. I don't know, but anyway, it is important to understand the distinction because they have very different tactics that they use to achieve the same totalitarian goal. So joining us now is Wayne Morrow, CEO of the John Birch Society. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Thank you, David. Appreciate being here. And it's Fabian's, much like the Council on Foreign Relations, very little known about people in their respective countries. It's sort of that secretive behind-the-scenes group. You know, that's part of the plan, you know?
And you mentioned, you told me just as we were talking here, just before you came on, how you there is also a book that the John Birch Society sells called The Fabian Freeway.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, very in-depth book. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a book we've written past, and we republished it. Mm-hmm. We have our own publishing company called The Western Islands. Mm-hmm. And The Fabian Freeway is a book about the genesis of the Fabians and how it impacted our U.S. policies and our foreign policies. It all ties together. But it's a real good book, and it's over about 600 pages, so it's not a quick read. But it's in-depth, and I think it's for people who are serious students about history. And what goes on today, certainly, I call it, we're the top of the puzzle box, you know. Now we understand what goes on.
That's right. That's right. So tell us a bit about us, about Fabian socialism. You know, what was it about that general that they liked, and how does that tell us about their tactics? And how is it different from Marxism?
Well, that's a good question. Well, anyway, the genesis is, as you mentioned, Quintus Fabius Maximus. He was a Roman general. Very slow moving. He was very, you know, quiet, but he was slow and forceful. Mm-hmm. And much like the Fabians took his name because that's the process they want. You know, their moniker originally was Wolf in Sheep's Clothing, and that didn't work over too well. Figure that one out for a while. And they said, now we'll switch to a turtle. Right?
I think the Republicans and Democrats could use that imagery as well. Instead of a donkey and an elephant, they could have a wolf and a sheep clothing for both of them. Yeah.
Now, they had to change their moniker because it wasn't going over well. But, you know, if you go back to the genesis of it all, Cecil Rhodes and Lord Milner were involved in forming this elite group. And George Bernard Shaw was certainly one of the members, and the Webb, Sidney Webb and all. And, you know, they were very open about socialism. And, you know, the dispute they had between Marx and themselves was they wanted to believe in the more the ethical, slow-moving educational route versus violence.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was their goal.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they formed, you know, the London School of Economics, and out of that school, you know, they put in place various key legislators in government and even in institutions around the UK. And they knew that by influencing public policy, it didn't make any difference who was the elected official because they were setting the policy. And they do that today, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
And so George Bernard Shaw was also very large on eugenics. Matter of fact, I don't have that video clip, but if you could listen to their audio clip, he talks about once every 5 years, listen to this one, we'd have to stand in front of this board to determine if we should be worthy of staying alive or not. He actually said that, you know. So he's going to go, imagine that.
Just destroyed my appreciation of My Fair Lady, right?
Can you imagine? So, and yeah. You can listen to it, you know, don't believe me, you can look him up, you can listen to the video, audio clip. It's amazing. And, you know, and so every prime minister, every Labour Party member of the UK is a Fabian. And so the Fabian's goal is always has been, as we call it, socialism, but it's a slow walk to Marxism.
Yeah.
And what they wanted to do is govern every aspect of your life and force globalism. So as you see now today with Keir Starmer, who, by the way, is a Fabian, as well as the mayor of London,
mm-hmm.
you're watching it happen, the country being destroyed. And I have podcasts with folks in London, and I tell them, this is all to cue. This is exactly what the plan is, to destroy their heritage, their history, to bring in, usher in world government.
Now, when
that's
you
exactly
say,
what it's all about. Yes.
Yes. When you say they're Fabians, is there still an organization that they belong as an active member, like somebody would belong to the John Birch Society? So they actually
absolutely right.
So have the Fabian Society there? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Tony Blair's a member of the Fabians, you know.
Card carrying member, yeah.
He's very active with it, by the way, you know, with the World Economic Forum.
Interesting.
But if you go online, you can look up the Fabian Society. They have organization in Australia. They're young Fabians, you know, but they exist. I mean, they exist today. And when I speak to the British, very few really understand the Fabians.
Mm-hmm.
Liz Truss, I met Liz Truss, a past prime minister. I was at a CEO conference, and I gave her my card, and I said, I'll send you a copy of the Fabian Freeway. Now she's actively doing YouTube phenomena. It's not because they said, you never mentioned the Fabians, Liz. But, you know, I think she knew exactly what they were. But the whole thing was, David, back in Woodrow Wilson's days, when he actually worked with Colonel Mandel House, another globalist, they formed this thing called the Inquiry. And the Inquiry was a group of men, we're British and U.S., and they disguised how are we going to work together and kind of really conquer the world as far as the political agenda, and then eventually total. And so that was the genesis of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Mm.
So the Council on Foreign Relations, which is housed in New York City, they and the Fabians worked together, as we speak today, in setting governance and policy. Mm. And they do that regardless of what the elections look like. They're behind the scenes doing foreign policy.
That's right.
And that's why we always look at each other. Why doesn't everything change? Well, that's because behind the scenes, the same folks have been working the agenda. That's what's going on. And we have to bring the light to the UK people, as well as the United States, that this group, these groups are hard at work directing our foreign policy, but our future. It is for world government. It's nothing to do with freedom.
Oh, great.
And our job at the Birch Society is through education to make people aware of who they are so we know what to do. It's not mystical. It's not magical. It's not a beauty contest when you elect somebody. But we have to know the threats are real, and we see it today.
Yes. It sounds very much like Antonio Gramsci, the father of the Italian Communist Party's strategy, where you wanted to march through the institutions. How is it different than Gramsci's communism? Because, and I mentioned Antonio Gramsci because Pete Buttigieg is what I call him, because he's very proud of that. But, you know, his father spent his entire career at Notre Dame. That was really his specialty, Antonio Gramsci. And he had him go to Harvard, where he studied under Sacvan Berkovich, who was also very much a fan of Italian communism. He changed his name to honor Sacco and Vanzetti. And you know, that I learned something about Antonio Gramsci because of Buttigieg, but I also called him Booty Marx because that's really where they're trying to take us. But again, it is a slow march through the institutions. And so what is the difference? Is it?
Hey, it's Ben Ferguson, and I want you to pause what you're doing for just 1 minute, and I want you to hear about love, generosity, and compassion. We say those words all the time, and they sound good. They feel good. But here's the truth. Those words don't mean anything unless they turn into action. And right now, not later today, not tomorrow, there's a child in the world who doesn't know if they'll eat, if they'll have a chance to learn, or if there's any hope at all. And while we're all busy, life keeps moving forward, but that child is waiting. This is where you come in. With Compassion International, you have the chance to change a child's future. Not just with words, not with promises, but with real help that provides food, education, and hope through local churches and people already in their community. Put your words into action and join me. Introduce a child to a loving Heavenly Father today at compassion.com. That's compassion.com.
Whether it's slots or live dealers, SpinQuest.com has the fun and action you're looking for. With SpinQuest exclusives, blackjack, roulette, baccarat, and even live dice with craps and bubble craps. The games never stop, so you don't have to. And right now, new users get $30 coin packs for just $10. Play now at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
That one of them was Italian and the other one was predominantly English and American, kind of Anglo?
Yeah, well, Gramsci was involved as an Italian. He was from Sardinia, and he was grew up in that area of farm. He watched the farmer owners take advantage of the farmer workers. He actually has a book called, David, called the Gramsci Papers, Prison Papers, and that's about this thing I have behind me in my library. And it was written on toilet paper, by the way. And he passed it to
his what it was worth.
He passed it to his sister, and it became the Gramsci, the prison papers. And Gramsci was, a threat to, the Nazis in Germany, and that's why it was called the Frankfurt School. And Hitler tossed him out of the United States. They ended up in Columbia University, and so the goal then was then to indoctrinate and reduce the morality of young college students and shove down their throats socialism and communism. So now we have the professors from various institutions in the country about, remember that in the 60s, about the hippie movement, all that was all coming from the Frankfurt School through Columbia University. Destroy. They knew they have, this is what Gramsci said, David, we can't destroy the United States or Western society as we talk to it economically. That's hard.
Yeah.
We have to change them morally. Because if we could do that, we could destroy the morality, because that's the glue that holds them together. Then we can destroy them. And that's the whole story with the Frankfurt School, which ended up at Columbia University. If you think about it, where we are back in the 40s to where today, you could see the morality of the United States going the other direction. And that's all according to plan.
And that's why they got so heavily involved in Hollywood and the entertainment business as well.
Absolutely correct. And that's what happened. So they knew that's exactly one of the key points that makes the United States and Western civilization so strong is our moral behavior and our beliefs. That's what we see today. But that's the difference between the two. And so they're Marxists, but they use that social element. They said Karl Marx wasn't right. He thought economics was the only way. No, we're going to have to do the moral end of it. So that's they morphed it into another strategy. But it's all the same end goal as total slavery.
And you can see that very much in what Sacvan Berkovich focused on there at Harvard. Everything for him was a product of Puritanism. And so we've got to overthrow this whole, the Puritan roots of America, and we've got to attack it at its foundation. But he was really, what he was trying to do was to attack the moral foundation of the country. That's why he focused on that so much. But everything he talked about was in terms of that. You know, well, this is because of the, you know, the Mayflower, and we've got to get rid of that. But it is kind of interesting, and of course, we see other approaches as well. You had people like Bill Ayers, okay? They decided that they would, they said, well, we've had class struggles over, you know, for Marxism in Europe. That's not going to work here. It's not working here that well. So let's go to a race struggle. So there's yet another approach that the communists have taken. They've got so many different prongs to get all of them. Take us to the same hell, don't they?
Yes.
A lot of different roads.
Yeah, we do the dirty work for them. We have, you know, class struggles, men against women. That's another big one right now. Children against their parents.
Yes.
Black versus white or tan. It's all about conflict and war. That's the that's their goal, because they need that to enforce more rules and regulations in the government and less freedom.
Mm-hmm.
You guys can't play nice. Okay, well, we're going to incite that. And, the Marxists knew that's one of the goals. And it's well written over a period of time. Lots of documentation on how that works.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the goal. So they're playing to our frailties of humans, you know, rich versus poor, black versus white, tan versus white, Chinese, whatever. Doesn't make a difference, because their end game is world government. And they know that they can't have a lot of us, so we have to exterminate some. So let those guys exterminate themselves.
That's right.
And that's what we see, you know. And we're seeing that now in the UK as we start our conversation about the Fabians. As I talk to the folks in the UK, we're watching their country. And I used to live there and work there in Oxfordshire, so I know the country rather well. And I'm watching those folks being destroyed by the invaders on purpose, but they're doing the dirty work, destroying all their history and for terror and terror into those folks in Ireland as well as the UK. And they're concerned. But I'm seeing a resurgence of the British citizen rising up. It was about a month ago, you recall, in London, they had people marching with the British flag. It wasn't 200,000, David. We had people that were there, and they said it was more like 3 million people were there. And you'll see farmer trucks now marching into London with their tractors. And they don't want to be slaves. And I've talked to enough Europeans. They don't want to be a part of the European EC any longer. They're losing their sovereignty. They love their history, David. And they really respect it. And when I travel throughout Europe, when I live there, they really love their history, and they love their heritage. It's being destroyed systematically, and it does not work. One thing I wanted to tell you, which is interesting, I found out talking to several of the folks within, you know, past legislators, they tell me they get their news about the United States in two ways, CNN and the New York Times. What does that tell you, David?
Yeah.
They need to get some different sources. You're going to see CNN. I go, what is that doing in there? You know, I'm in Hungary or I'm in Italy. I'm watching CNN. That's how they look at the United States. I said, well, that's totally upside down. You know?
Yeah. Well, I had a friend who worked in the Pentagon in about 20 or 30 years ago. And when I talked to him, he said, yeah, CNN is playing on the screen all over the Pentagon, all the different rooms and everything. You know?
Oh, yeah.
That's
Communist News Network.
That's right. It's very important that who you listen to. And, you know, and I've always tried to listen to various sources. And I would go to I always preferred people who would tell me what they think and why they think it, rather than the people who try to be this mushy middle, like Time and Newsweek, you know. So I was always looking at The Nation or National Review or something like that. Even though I don't support their views, I'd like to see that conflict that was there, because a lot of times that would help me to understand where I stood on the issue. So I try to get these people that are opposed to each other. But most people just go for something like Time or Newsweek or CNN, and it's kind of the mushy middle that's put out there by the Mockingbird programs that are out there for people. But that's why it's very important for people to educate themselves. And that's a very important thing that you do at the John Birch Society. Tell us a little bit about the John Birch Society and how it's organized at local
areas. We started in 1958, and our goal is education. You know, education is really critical for us, educating people about American values. Mm-hmm. Our job is limited government. You know, so people call us far right. That's not true. We're actually constitutional moderates, some form of government, but not total.
Mm-hmm.
All the left is all the isms, clearly fascism, right?
Mm-hmm.
And our job is to teach Americanism. It's not taught anymore. So we have free courses online, the jbs.org, about teaching about the Constitution. And we say, how do you elect constitutional minority representatives, state, local, or federal, if you don't know the playbook? So mm-hmm. how do you hold them accountable?
Yeah.
And it's not taught on purpose. So now it becomes a personality contest. We don't want that. So we teach people Americanism, and we give them the history, and we show them who's behind the curtain, like we mentioned the Fabians and the CFR, and who's forming foreign policy. And once people know what goes on, that's important. We call it a conspiracy. It's not a theory any longer.
Mm-hmm.
But the conspiracy says this. The first goal is to deny its existence, of course.
Yes.
So we said, look, let's expose them. It's not us. That's why I have 1,000 books behind me. Is that over the course of time, it proves that they does exist, and they actually come out and talk about it.
Hey, it's Ben Ferguson, and I want you to pause what you're doing for just 1 minute, and I want you to hear about love, generosity, and compassion. We say those words all the time, and they sound good. They feel good. But here's the truth. Those words don't mean anything unless they turn into action. And right now, not later today, not tomorrow, there's a child in the world who doesn't know if they'll eat, if they'll have a chance to learn, or if there's any hope at all. And while we're all busy, life keeps moving forward, but that child is waiting. This is where you come in. With Compassion International, you have the chance to change a child's future. Not just with words, not with promises, but with real help that provides food, education, and hope through local churches and people already in their community. Put your words into action and join me. Introduce a child to a loving Heavenly Father today at compassion.com. That's compassion.com.
You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That two-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps, with a live dealer. New players' $30 coin packs are on sale for 10 bucks. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
It's interesting, as we look through time and look through history, I always go back to my UK experience where Aldous Huxley was a Fabian. I go back to that for a second to mm-hmm. answer your question. And what happened is he was writing, this guy was a young author, writing all the information about what he heard. And he was so excited about it that he decided to write a book. And he said, I can't use my pen name. My name is Eric Blair. I can't use that. I have to use a pen name, so I think my name is George and Orwell. George Orwell is really the Eric Blair, and he wrote 1984 about the Fabians. The question becomes, why is it 1984? Well, January 4th of 1884 is the foundation of the Fabians, and they said within 100 years we have world government. That's why that book's titled 1984.
Oh, so interesting. I'd heard people say because he wrote it in 1948, but
I don't believe that because he was indoctrinated by H.G. Wells mm-hmm. and Aldous Huxley about when he writes about Big Brother, Newspeak. That's all about the Fabians.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
now that's in vogue, I'm saying, hey, look, that wasn't done as a science fiction. That was really his telling you, and he couldn't, you know, hold himself. He said, I have to really talk about this. That's why I personally believe that's why it's 1984. It's 100 years of existence. And of course, I mentioned the Council on Foreign Relations is a child of the Fabians, and now we have an American version, and we have, you know, the European version. Work in unison. So our job at the Birch Society is educate people what's going on, to be personally responsible, to elect constitutional moderates and constitution-minded representatives, state, local, and federal, so we can monitor not only our behavior, but go back to constitutional based law and not rule by elitists. And that's what we see today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, and it's important for people to understand how many different ways they come at us in order to set up a totalitarian government. They have so many different tactics and strategies. And, of course, one of those, I think, that you're talking about, Aldous Huxley and others like that, H.G. Wells and Huxley, the technocracy that was there. I mean, talk a little bit about technocracy as well. That's really kind of coming to us. People don't really know where to fit that, you know, because it doesn't really fit into the left-right paradigm. And yet that seems to be on the ascendancy as well. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know the story about technology. You know, but have a fellow used to be a member of the Birth Society, was in the CIA. He said, smile a lot because your picture gets taken about 300 times a day.
That's right. More than that now, I guess.
You go bank, grocery store, going to get gas. But technocracy is a tool for monitoring and governance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you see AI data centers and all, every little thing that you've done. And they openly said this in the Bank of International Settlements. They want to have this digital currency where they can monitor any of your expenditures from $100 on up.
Mm-hmm.
So they can determine by checking China if you have a bad social score, then you're not going to buy anything. So if you think about technology is going to be their weapon or tool to keep you in line. That's where I see it happening. And they're doing it through a lot of different angles. It looks kind of cool, but that's really the goal.
One of the things I began the program with today was talking about the fact that, I mention all the time about how artificial intelligence is really going to be a superpower for any kind of government tyranny, to be able to monitor you and everything that you're doing, as you're just talking about, but also to manipulate opinion as well. And that's why it's very concerning to me to see that this latest executive order from Trump that essentially presumes to prohibit any state laws that would curb things that are happening with AI companies. Because I think where that would really happen would be with the data centers. I think it's where the big conflict is going to come.
That's very true.
And, you know, that is the bottleneck for them. And that would be one of the ways that you could limit them to buy a little bit of time to try to get some control of the situation or structure to keep some of these things at bay. But, again, to prohibit that at the federal level, and that is in direct conflict with the 10th Amendment. And, of course, the Democrats will tell you that now because they're not in power. But as soon as they get in power, they don't care about the 10th Amendment either. But it is really a real concern about this concentration of power and the destruction of the 10th Amendment. And, of course, the enforcement mechanism that it's going to run through is going to be to use financial carrots and sticks for people. Coming out of the federal government, that's the way they always get around the 10th Amendment, isn't it?
Absolutely correct. Yes, the technocracy. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what we call technocracy. The techno-bureaucrats. Mm-hmm. That's where they use that technology, as I call it, digital prison. That's basically what you're looking at.
Yes.
And that's kind of where we're at.
Yeah.
And that's what they're setting up, digital prison. So you can't go anywhere to do anything within your 15-minute city, whatever you want to be, to monitor where you are.
And so
you lose all your freedoms.
They're constantly coming up with different justifications to take us to the same kind of Orwellian hell that they want to set up. And that's why, you know, when you look at the Chinese communists, many times I'd look at them and say, okay, so are they really communist anymore, or are they fascist? Because they've kind of merged economics and politics to a great extent there, and it's highly nationalistic and all the rest of these other things. So it's important to understand all these different strains, but then to not get boxed in by any of them, to understand these people mix and match. They'll take whatever they can use, many of these different strategies, and, you know, when you look at them, if you were to construct a Venn diagram, it seems like they're all starting to reach convergence instead of one little point of overlap, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, communism is just a tool. It's a tool for global governance.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
not the be-all, end-all, just
That's
like
right.
any other religious things that we see. It's got nothing to do with it at all. Matter of fact, the men who are globalists are not communists. They're not. That's a tool.
Mm-hmm.
They're not fascists, but they use that mentality. But it's all a tool for world government. It's all going to come through the United Nations. And you see the UN.
Mm-hmm.
That's the center point of it all. And we have a magazine called The New American.
Mm-hmm.
And matter of fact, we're actually launching it in there called The New European. And I can show you this.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Map here. David, these little bubble diagrams, if you can see this all, these are all the UN offices in the world.
Huh.
They're not just one location in, you know, the East River in Brussels.
Yeah, yeah.
So what are these people doing in all these locations? Well, you're on the menu. That's what's going on. So you can imagine all those, you know, it's all over the United States. So I'd be happy to send this to you. In a New America magazine, we have this one called The Global Power Grab.
Mm-hmm.
We did this one, and it talks, and I show this around the Australians and the New Zealands and the UK folks and the lady in France. They were totally amazed. The depth of the United Nations, all these offices all over the world.
Yes.
And they're busy carving up the world for global governance. So that's what our part of our job at the Birch Society, expose what's happening through education and make it aware. It's not too late because it's more of us than them, and they know that. Their job is to keep us off message
mm-hmm.
and looking at sports figures or Hollywood or mm-hmm. this or that. At the same time, they're destroying our foundational principles of freedom.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I've had Alex Newman on many times. I've talked to Alex, and a great guy there at the New American, and I've had other people as well from the New American. It's a great publication. And as you point out with that map, and you see all the different areas where they have areas of responsibility and actual physical locations and everything, I think that's a key thing for people to understand, is that it's not necessarily going to be, as you point out, in Brussels when you say, well, there's the seat of government or whatever, or the East River in New York. It really is not so much about that. It's about global governance. It's about this network of different organizations that are out there. And that's one of the things that I see about technocracy. It's really that, not just, you know, the electronic networking that's out there, but actually the political networking that is there. And the interlocking of these different financial interests that are out there. So they can all have their own goals and things, but it is all pushing us towards this global governance, and the technology is really giving them power that they've never had before. That's the key thing that's really concerning me. So
we saw that with COVID-19 was a good data set beta test for them, how you had the whole world under control. I'm sure they were absolutely laughing and amazed how easy it was to
make
that happen.
I know. I was absolutely astounded how easy it was for them as well. And again, I think, you know, we look at the stimulus checks and all the rest of this stuff. That was training wheels for universal basic income, which was something that Elon Musk has always been focused on. When you had Andrew Yang come out, said he was going to run for president, and that was going to be his issue, the main issue. He branched out into some other things later on. But as soon as he came out and said universal basic income, Elon Musk handed him $1 million. You know, he wanted him to push that idea. Well, it got pushed really big in 2020, didn't it?
Well, that's all part of the program, universal mm-hmm. income through the UN. Yeah, of course it is.
Yeah.
The whole job, they want you to be industrious. They want you to be collective, not individualists.
Mm-hmm.
And we fight collectivism.
Mm-hmm.
We believe in individualism, not collectivism. That's all part of the rule. You know,
mm-hmm.
there's a call it the herd mentality,
mm-hmm.
and that's exactly what they need to control us. It's mm-hmm. all that's the end game. Mm-hmm. Is that world government, and they'll determine, as I mentioned early on, we started in the show, George Bernard Shaw, before the Eugenics Committee, who lives and who dies.
Mm-hmm.
And you may not have that choice.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a strong Christian or belief, you may not fit into, because they're amoral, they don't have any beliefs, the state is their belief, you may not fit into their program. If you can't be indoctrinated correctly, mm-hmm. you may be exterminated.
That's right.
And they're written about that. So it's, these guys play for keeps, and it's serious, and our job has been to expose their plan since the late 50s on really what they want to do. And they're very open about it, now more so than ever, because they feel like young adults have been so indoctrinated through the universities and school that socialism is good, like we saw the last mayor race in New York City. I mean, can you imagine? It's, nothing's free. You know?
The schools have indoctrinated that. But then we also have the situation where the the Gen Z people are finding it very difficult to find a job, even if they go to college, they're finding it difficult to find a job, and that mm-hmm. is something I think that really drives this, because again, one of the things that socialism has always pushed out there, I think, is envy. You know, they find these different at its core. I think Saul Alinsky, you know, dedicated his book Rules for Radicals to Satan, and I think at the core of it, there's all these different satanic appeals to the evil aspects of our nature, you know, whether it's about greed, whether it's about envy, whether it's about hatred, racism, tribalism, all these different things. and they identify these things and seek to exploit them with these different approaches that they take, you know. And so that's what I think is you have to be aware of the tactics and the strategies that are there if we're ever going to be able to defeat them. Otherwise, we're just putty in their hands, aren't we?
That's exactly right. And you're exactly correct. That's exactly what they do. They pit one group against another, one philosophy, because it's all about conflict.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about the conflict. That's critically important. But we have to identify what it is and expose what it is. That's really important. So we know the game. It's a charades. You remember the movie where we had with Julie Garland, Follow Yellow Brick Road, you know, and all of a sudden, who's mm-hmm. that man behind the curtain? Don't pay attention to him. Mm-hmm. Well, we expose who's behind the curtain, you know, and that's really what it's all about. It's really a plan. It's not done by accident. And we see a lot of kabuki theater.
Yes.
But the thing is that we identify really what it is. And to tell you what, it's very difficult for people to believe it because some of their heroes of the past were not good people.
That's right.
And I'm sorry, folks.
Or the heroes of the present.
Or the present.
Yeah, that's
I mentioned about George Bernard Shaw. The guy was, you know, think about that one. Well, I mean, I can go on, but there's a lot of them. And they were not who they thought they were. I mean,
that's
it's...
Right. Yeah, he wrote Pygmalion, which was then turned into My Fair Lady, you know, the musical and the play, and you know, we enjoy the music with that. But, the guy who was there, and even when you look at all these different science fiction novels, they've basically become a blueprint for them. But when you're talking about how they like to set up conflict between different groups, that's why I think we really need to have our guard up about partisan politics, because that is another way they do it. They don't just do it by race or by sex or this or that. They do it also with political factions. And, you know, when people buy into these things and start to excuse the actions of their leaders, what they really need to do is to look at the longer historical view and say, where were the Fabian socialists trying to take us? You know, where were the Gramsci socialists trying to take us? Where were the Marxists trying to take us? And if the actions of the person that's the hero of your party is going to move us in the direction of these socialists and Marxists, then you need to pull back and say, we're not going to follow that, even though that's part of our tribe here or whatever. I think that's a very important thing.
Oh,
you know,
right. Elections change governments, but institutions, you know, change nations. That's really important. They actually, Fabius even said that. They also said power shifts from representation to management. And that's where we are.
Mm-hmm.
No matter, you know, it's left or right, you know, on the politics scene, the policy being set forward doesn't make a difference who runs back and forth. It's all kabuki theater for us because they're not setting the policy, someone else is. And we identify who they are. That's really critically important.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all a big game in front of us, but we have to identify really who they are and what's happening. And that's all part of what we do, educate people and make them aware. There's more of us than them.
Mm-hmm.
But our job is to wake people up. And sometimes they don't want to, they want to hear about it, you know.
Yeah.
Our job is to wake people up and tell them really what's going on. Much like the story I gave to the UK folks about the Fabians.
Mm-hmm.
I said, look, they're destroying your country on plan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's not by accident. It's not
and
by
that's
accident.
Why, you know, I question, you know, so do they still have a Fabian society that people belong to? Because typically these things are done in secret. You know, or quietly. So you have secret societies, you know, things like the Masons or whatever, but, you know, people will be members of this. But I don't think, do we have a Fabian society that you have politicians that are part of here in the U.S., or is it mainly the CFR that you'll see?
Mostly the CFR.
Yeah.
It's exactly. What's it, you know, it's a partner of with the Fabians. So back to Cecil Rhodes and Lord Milner and, you know, Woodrow Wilson took Commander House. They had this thing called the Inquiry back in the 1900s or so, and they formed this group, and they went to the United States, and the Council of Foreign Relations was born in 1921, and they're going to set foreign policy up, marked through David Rockefeller. And today you have members of the cabinet, 40-50% of the people in presidential cabinets were part of the CFR. You know, had Clinton, Eisenhower, all those guys were all involved in the CFR. They knew exactly what was going on. So they were carrying the water for the CFR policy group. And that's exactly what goes on. So it looked good,
mm-hmm.
you know, but reality is, one of the stories goes this way.
Hey, it's Ben Ferguson, and I want to be honest with you for a second about how an act of compassion really feels. A couple of years ago, I made the choice to partner with an amazing organization called Compassion International. Why? Because I wanted to sponsor a child in need. It was a nice idea, sure, but I had no idea just how much that simple act would change my life as well. I sponsored Nadia and got to watch her life change right in front of my eyes, going from starving literally alone on the streets to getting the health care and education she needs to reach her God-given full potential. I got to be a part of that change, and the light of that compassion not only illuminates in her, it illuminates now in me. That is the power of compassion. The light of Christ shines on all of us. Feel it for yourself and change literally a child's life. Change the world, and you also change yourself. You can sponsor a child today. Visit compassion.com. That's compassion.com.
Are you in Texas, and are you tired of not being able to play blackjack, roulette, and even craps? Well, guess what? I got the solution for you. SpinQuest.com. That's SpinQuest.com. Has over 1,000 slots and table games you can play from the comfort of your own home, absolutely free, with the ability to win real cash prizes. Now get in your big diesel truck and go play SpinQuest today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
You know, every year, we have an election. It's like when you're in high school. You know, remember the president of the student council? Remember those back in high school?
Mm-hmm. And, beauty contest, you know, yeah.
Remember that? Yeah, and by the way, I'm going to have longer lunch hours. We're going to have less homework, right? And all of a sudden, they get elected, and they're like, who's running the show? The superintendent of the principal of high school. It never happened. And that's the story with the CFR. We have a beauty contest, which is a public, you know, either presidential election or congressional. And then who's running the show behind the scenes? It's really those groups, those unelected bureaucratic officials or unelected. And we expose what they are. We have that book called The Shadows of Power. Another book that we published years ago called The Shadows of Power exposes the Council on Foreign Relations, World War I, World War II, Korean, Vietnam, how they all morphed into all part of the plan. That's called The Shadows of Power. So now so the Fabians is Freeway is about the Fabians. The Shadows of Power is about the Council on Foreign Relations. And once people look at history, they get pretty angry because they know it's all been a theater for not for us, but for them.
Yeah.
And they play the game to make it look like you're running the show, but you're not. You're just a victim of the globalist plan.
I agree. And when I think of the John Birch Society, you guys have done a great job of educating people about the Council on Foreign Relations, the CFR stuff. And yet we still have these people run for office, and I think you'll see them proudly list that as part of their CV, you know, that, I'm a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. And it surprises me. It's like, I'm part of this satanic group over here. But it's, they see it as a, because it really does have a lot of panache or whatever or clout in Washington to be a member of that club, and they're proud of it. And so we need to call them out on it. We need to understand the history of it, and we need to understand really just how evil the actions have been and how that has really been there. So I guess in the UK, they still have people who are part of the Fabian Society, but here you'll see it in the CFR, and they'll be doing the same type of thing.
Yeah, Bill Clinton was a member. Madeleine Albright was a member. Robert Rubin was a member. Ben Cohen, Larry Summers, George W. Bush was. Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, Robert Gates, Henry Paulson, Barack Obama was president. Describe a candidate. Timmy Gaithard, Susan Rice, John Bolton, Henry McMaster, and Mike Pompeo. I do go on. You see what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
So they're there in strategic locations to monitor and steer public policy. That's what it's going on. So when you see this, and we hear the song, regardless of it's Democrat, Republican, you get to the same place all the time.
That's right.
That's the key.
And I remember when Reagan got elected, people were excited. Oh, look, he's not CFR, And I can't remember the last time we had a president that wasn't CFR. And yet what he did was he put CFR people in all the different positions around him,
Yes, exactly. Well, Trump is not a member of the CFR, I can tell you that, so he's not a member. So. But he's got people around to make sure he doesn't get too far off the script, although he does.
That's right. I think with Trump, it's really, as much as anything, it's the technocracy, because these guys are writing the checks there. I'm very concerned that, we all know now what the CBDC is, and yet... I think the same thing can be accomplished with a stable coin, and they can make a lot of money putting the stablecoin out there at the same time. You know? Yeah. So it's one way they can get rich. They can get rich off of that, or they can't get rich off of the CBDC. And since everybody's kind of wise to the game of the CBDC, they don't realize that stablecoin is still going to have those capabilities to be able to turn off your ability to trade and do other things like that. Tell us a little bit about the John Birch Society. I mean, I know you guys have had a lot of fights and that type of thing. Have you been hit with any kind of debanking or stuff like that? Because, I mean, I have. And I've been kicked off of PayPal and Venmo and other formats like that because of things that I was saying in 2020 about the lockdown and the pandemic and the vaccine and climate change and all the rest of this stuff. Are you seeing that kind of debanking and deplatforming in various places?
Yeah, well, sometimes we say that we get too much of truth. YouTube will take us down for a while or something like that, and then we'll come back on again. You know, we don't have that issue with banking per se, but they ignore us because they don't need attention. We get attacked, you know, we start to grow. So they try to pretend we don't exist any longer.
Yeah, that's when I first learned of the John Birch Society was when William F. Buckley was on a tear.
National
Review to come after you guys. It's like, well, I think I agree with these guys and not with Buckley. So
he's a CFR member, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably CIA as well. So
Skull and Bones, you know, from Yale. You know, I can go on. He was a good guy, right? Yeah, sure. You know, his organization exists today. And don't listen to those guys over there. You know, okay.
Yeah, that's why he was a good guy. That's why NPR had him on. That's why.
Yeah, right. Sometimes people go, we wrote a book about that called The Pied Piper of the Establishment. We wrote that book, Jack McMaster, a past president, you may have known him. He wrote the book about Buckley, and he was, you know, he was all put together to make sure that he steers the conservative movement their direction of the CFR, in which he was a member of the CFR.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like, you know, as I said, it's not matter who, it's all controlled, you know, it's.
Yeah.
And he was control opposition.
He's a very poster child for that, isn't he? Controlled opposition.
Yeah, absolutely correct. And people still hold him up as he was some, you know, super conservative. He was not.
Yeah. I remember, you know, Rush Limbaugh really idolized him. It's like, man, you don't realize who this guy is. That's kind of telling. But anyway, it really is a great organization, and really do appreciate what you guys do. And again, the Quiet Ideology Reshaping Policy, From London Parlors to DC Power. Is that a book or is that an article? Because that's how I found out about
that
you.
Sounds like it sounds like the Fabian Freeway. That's what it sounds like.
Okay, that's the subtitle of Fabian Freeway.
Playing over,
Okay,
but the JBS has been around for a long time. We have area chapters.
Mm-hmm.
We educate people on the voting record of their representatives. And so we try to encourage people to be active participants in the process. How do you change your representative, David, is if you don't understand the Constitution, or at least go visit them and say, why did you vote unconstitutionally? So we have this thing called the scorecard.
Mm-hmm.
We print it out every quarter, and it talks about the voting record. Constitutionally, we pick them on Congress, you know, Senate as well as the House, where they are. So people know if they're voting constitutionally or not. And it's our personal responsibility as Americans to uphold, remember, the representatives work for us and say, hey, why are you voting this way? And would they have not? I mean, representative called me and said, no one ever, very rarely calls me on the phone and talks about anything.
Yeah.
And so we can't, it's not, you know, we can't sit back and I said, and one day we have a handsome young conservative show up in Congress. It doesn't happen that way.
Yeah.
So
that's right.
My biggest goal is fight complacency in Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And it's life is too good.
Mm-hmm.
And even though the economics today is hurting them, now they're listening, but life is too good. And they have to, you know, we have to get behind and spend a little time protecting our sovereignty and our freedoms. But we have to know who we are first. And that's what we try to teach, Americanist principles, and hold up representatives who work for us to make sure that happens.
I agree,
and that's
what I liked about the John Birch Society was the focus on local activism as well, and you know, knowing what is happening locally in your state as well. And I've seen what you're talking about in terms of representatives who say, nobody ever calls me. I saw the power of that, and I've talked about this on the program. When I lived in North Carolina, I was involved with homeschooling, and at that point in time, all of North Carolina's government was Democrat. Democrat House and Senate, as well as the governor and all the rest of the stuff. So they decided, the teachers unions decided that they're...
Hey, it's Ben Ferguson, and I want you to pause what you're doing for just 1 minute, and I want you to hear about Alejandra. She lives in a remote community with very few resources and little to no health care. So when Alejandra gets sick, her parents have no real options, no doctors in their community, and no money for real medical care. By the third day, her body was shutting down. She woke up and just long enough to tell her mom, "I can't take the pain anymore. I can't keep going." Her parents drove hours to find a doctor who tried everything, but she needed a private hospital, and that was impossible for her family to afford. And that is when Compassion International stepped in. Now, through Compassion, Alejandra was treated, and against all odds, she survived. She lived because someone, just like you, took action. Right now, unfortunately, there are children just like Alejandra who won't survive unless someone like you steps in. Compassion International partners with local churches, providing children with the support that they need, critical medical care, plus food, education, and the hope of the gospel, all in Jesus' name. So help a child just like Alejandra today. You can visit compassion.com. That's compassion.com.
What's going on, Texas? It's Bluff here. Do you like playing casino-style games like blackjack, baccarat, craps, and slots? Well, SpinQuest.com, that's SpinQuest.com, has over 1,000 games available for you to play from the comfort of your own home. New players get $30 coin packages for only $10 and instant cash prize redemption. Now, what are you doing? Put that barbecue down, quit sweeping those tumbleweeds, and get to playing.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
We're going to shut down homeschooling, and it looked like they were going to be able to do it because it was all Democrats. And an active minority of homeschoolers, which was really small at the time. There wasn't a lot of people homeschooling. There's so many more who are doing it today. But everybody got actively involved and started writing, and it made them look so much bigger than they actually were. And actually beat down the teachers' unions in a Democrat state that were going to try to regulate homeschooling out of existence. And so that is was a very important firsthand lesson to learn. But it's difficult to get people to do that. And that's one of the things that the John Birch Society does, I think, is excellent, which is to educate each other about what is happening locally within your state and how you can take action at a local level. I remember my probably my earliest memory of the John Birch Society was the Support Your Local Sheriff stuff, being concerned about the federalization and of the police. And that is something that is now really escalating, isn't it?
Yeah. We actually have that group. It still exists, called Support Your Local Police. We want to keep them independent, not federalized. We have a group. We have an affiliate, not-for-profit, called Support Your Local Police. And we also have you mentioned school. With the homeschool, we've been in existence for 15 years, called the Freedom Project Academy. It goes from kindergarten to high school. Mm. We have live, education, of course, online, or you can buy a recorded version of it. And that's been around. So we're educating all over the world. Adults are having their children sign up to learn really Americanism, who we are, not fabricated history. And we teach you kids how to write cursive and do math and read books. How about that for a change? And so it hasn't happened in a public school, I can tell you that.
Yeah.
And we spent more time in education than social, emotional learning. But the thing is, and you mentioned Alice Newman, wrote a lot of books about that. But the thing is that, so we look at education with our children, our adults, bring into view really who we are, what we're all about, because we've been indoctrinated.
Yes.
And we know that brainwashing has existed through all the mass media, David.
Mm-hmm.
All the mass media, as you know very well because you're in the media business, that's all controlled by the Council on Foreign Relations. Every one of those, New York Times, all the networks, including Fox News, it's all controlled media. And they all say the same thing, same deal. So guess what? If that's the only thing you hear, that's the only thing you believe.
That's right.
We said, no, time out. Let's talk about reality here. And it's hard for some people to swallow, but once you've been red-pilled, all of a sudden the world changes. Like, now I see what's going on here. So that's our job in the Birch Society. We deal with kids with school, You're right about the law enforcement. We want to keep them independent. We teach the Constitution. We get people involved. It's about education and get people activated and involved. That's really important.
I absolutely agree.
Get activated and involved. And that's how we save our country, as well as the people over in England. They see the problem now because they're watching their country be destroyed. And I mentioned the Fabians when we first came on because that's coming attractions for the United States. Mm-hmm. What you see in Europe is coming attractions for here.
Oh, yeah. Just so it's delayed like just a little bit. Yeah.
It's a warning. It's a
that's
warning.
Right. Yeah, and so, you know, getting back to the federalization of the police, you know, we look at these things and we say, okay, even if you like the guy who's doing it, and even if you agree with the stated goal, you have to look at this and say, yeah, but that policy is going to establish a precedent of the federalization of law enforcement. And so I know where that leads, right? So we pull this back and we say, okay, so let's walk this back, and we have to oppose this, even if we agree with the stated purpose, that's the wrong way to do it. And it is so important that we not sacrifice the end does not justify the means. That's how these people always get us there. And it's understanding those principles and what America is about, understanding the Constitution and what that's about and why those things are there. Those important safeguards against tyranny, and understand that if we wipe those things away because it's going to make it more expedient for us to achieve this particular policy goal, we are going to pay the price in the long run, aren't we?
A nationalized police force is Karl Marx's plan, and so that's what we're trying to avoid, keep them local and independent.
That's
your
right.
Sheriff is a very important person in your county, very important person, and I encourage people to know who the sheriff is and talk to them and making sure that you understand and they understand about America's principles and our rights. Mm-hmm. And you have to know who the sheriff is so they know who you are. Much like your legislators and state legislators. You know, go back to our basics of our country. Our United States were formed as independent states, sovereign states.
Mm-hmm.
And over a period of time, David, the states have given power from themselves to the federal government. That's not the way it was supposed to operate.
Yeah.
The government was supposed to defend us against public and domestic enemies, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's very limited powers. Look at Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. Very limited powers Congress has, right?
Mm-hmm.
And government. And so we have actually given more power to the federal government, why it's all upside down and distorted today. So we spend time with our local legislators in each state to make sure they uphold the constitutional responsibility. Each state has a constitution. The word democracy does not exist. It's always a republic. That's a whole other thing we teach people. That word does not appear in our constitution or any state constitution. And people don't even know that.
Yeah.
And I said, you have to understand states are sovereign. Make sure you make, this is where it begins. So if you look at our history, it was done with that phenomenal idea to keep them sovereign, independent states. So those basic things I just said to you, most Americans I talk to do not understand that.
Yeah,
they don't understand at all.
That's right. They absolutely do not, and it's so important that we understand foundational principles and why these things were set up the way they were. Actually, is a good plan. You know, even though the Constitution has been completely violated, it's still a good plan, and we should try it someday in our lifetime. I think.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like the Ten Commandments. It's not the Ten Suggestions. You know.
That's right. That's right. And they all
the Constitution. You have to know it before you can uphold it. You know.
Mm-hmm. And everybody, pretty much, whether they're local or state or especially federal, they take an oath to the Constitution as a requirement of their authority. And so when they violate that, they no longer have any legitimate authority, but they do have a lot of power. And so we need to understand that we can have power collectively, and that's one of the things I think the John Birch Society does bring to the table. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a fascinating discussion, Mr. Morrow.
Thank you, David.
Wayne Morrow.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. Wayne Morrow, the CEO of the John Birch Society. Always great talking to you guys. We're going to take a quick break, folks, and we'll be right back. I want to talk a little bit about what's going on with cars here in just a second. So we'll be right back. Stay with us. Thank you.
listening to The David Knight Show.
Hey, it's Ben Ferguson, and I want to be honest with you for a second about how an act of compassion really feels. A couple of years ago, I made the choice to partner with an amazing organization called Compassion International. Why? Because I wanted to sponsor a child in need. It was a nice idea, sure, but I had no idea just how much that simple act would change my life as well. I sponsored Nadia and got to watch her life change right in front of my eyes, going from starving literally alone on the streets to getting the health care and education she needs to reach her God-given full potential. I got to be a part of that change, and the light of that compassion not only illuminates in her, it illuminates now in me. That is the power of compassion. The light of Christ shines on all of us. Feel it for yourself and change literally a child's life. Change the world, and you also change yourself. You can sponsor a child today. Visit compassion.com. That's compassion.com.
It's Bretzky. I don't know how they let me on this podcast, but while I'm here, I might as well tell you the only place to play blackjack, roulette, and live craps in Texas is SpinQuest.com, baby. That's SpinQuest.com. New users get a $30 coin package for only $10. I mean, that's a hell of a deal for all you 10-gallon hat wearers down there in Texas.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Listening to The David Knight Show.
Tell Alexa to add the APS radio skill and have access to the best channels anywhere. From country to blues, classic hits to news, APS radio curates incredibly diverse playlists for you to enjoy. Get details at APSradio.com.
Welcome back, folks. We got a lot of comments. And Jersey Boy, thank you so much for the support. He says, can you please ask if he was ever heard of William Cooper, who wrote Behold a Pale Horse.
I'm sorry, I didn't see that comment in time. I'm sorry.
And does he know about Jimmy from Brooklyn, who JBS interviewed, who I'm trying to get on your show?
Okay. Well, yeah, I'm sorry I missed that. I'm very sorry.
Yes, apologies. Mm-hmm. Owen61, thank you so much for the support. He just says, thank you.
Well, thank you, Owen. Appreciate it.
Yes, thank you so much. And Jersey Boy again says, I remember a few years ago from JBS an email, History of Republicans, it was started by a communist. Does he know what it was? And what does he think of JFK?
It's interesting. A book I really enjoyed was an alternative history book by Harry Turtledove. He's written a lot of alternative history books, and this one was about the Civil War. It's called How Few Remain. And in it, you may know the history that Antietam, as bloody as the battle was, could have been a victory for the South, except that one of the couriers dropped the orders that he was carrying, and they fell into the Union's hands. And so in his book, guy said, hey, you dropped those orders. Better pick those up. Can you imagine what would happen if the other guys got that right? And so that causes an early end to the war. And pretty much all the major figures of both North and South survive. And causes an early end of the war and the South to gain its independence. And in his alternative history, Lincoln is entirely discredited because he lost the war. But then he makes a comeback as this book is picking up a couple of decades on. At that point in time, I think he's got Stonewall Jackson as the president of the Confederacy. And Lincoln makes a political comeback as head of the Socialist Party. And that's one of the things that made that book so interesting, was you really did understand these people, what motivated them, and the things behind them. And so, yeah, there was an early connection with that. And if you look at, always think about the Pledge of Allegiance that was put in by the Grand Army of the Republic, most of the veterans, especially if they were well-known or successful, played an important part in the war, they got very big positions in the subsequent governments that were there. And the Grand Army of the Republic, which was the organization of Civil War veterans for the North, had a tremendous amount of influence. They were the ones who instituted the Pledge of Allegiance, and it initially did not have "under God" in it until the mid-1950s. And so the emphasis was on one nation, indivisible, and that, you know, very harsh with that. And the pledge was done with one arm extended out, palm down, just like the Nazi salute. They changed it to "hand over your heart" because of the Nazi salute. But yeah, socialism and a lot of other things were there, and the as well as the concentration of power, really talking about the destruction of the states as sovereign entities, and the understanding that the states had created the federal government. All that stuff disappeared with the Civil War. Go ahead.
We have username 01234567 89. AI will be kosher and DEI. Nibiru 2029 says, "We have the best government money can buy," and that's a quote from Mark Twain. And they spend more and more every single day. Pezzanovante 1776, "Ask the guest his take on war, Gaza, Trump's anti-Semitism czar, and the Heritage Foundation's Project Esther."
I apologize, I didn't see that. Yes.
The conversation was too good. Gar Goldsmith says, "Curiously, people often claim Marx was focused solely on economics, but his entire worldview was cultural, based on envy and hate."
Yeah. Conflict, yeah. The Hegelian dialectic. That's why, you know, we have to look at the different ways that they divide us. You know, it was very explicit what Bill Ayers and Bernardine Dorn, the Weathermen, wanted to do. They wanted to have a race war. Marx focused, the thing about economics was there, but that was really a class struggle, right? And the economics was a part of that class struggle. And but it's always about dividing us. And that's why I said, you know, we have to be very careful about the Republican versus Democrat thing. Any kind of division that they can use like that. And when we attach ourselves to a different ethnic group or a different political group, these different types of things, those attachments draw us away from the principles that can be the bulwark against this kind of socialist hell that they want to put us in. Yeah.
And Mama C, 1996, says, "I never learned so much as when I was homeschooling my kids."
That's right. That's right. That's excellent. And that was the thing that I really missed about it. That was where I put all of my effort before I had the show. As a matter of fact, that was at one point, it was kind of bothering me because I was filling in for Alex at the very beginning. He said, "You know, there's going to be millions of people listening to you." I said, "Don't tell me that. I need to hear that right now." But because I was not very much into public speaking or anything like that. And I said, "No, the way I think of this," and that was in his original studio, which was really small and intimate. I said, "The way I think of this is I'm talking to the guys over there running the board. I could see them." And I said, I'm just thinking like I'm doing homeschooling with my kids. So I said, "Don't talk to me about millions of people listening to that. That'll freeze me up." So that's the way I always looked at it. And it was such a wonderful thing because it gave us an opportunity to go back and look at content that was compelled on us in the schools and to view it in a different way. And that's one of the things I've always said about biology and evolution. You know, when it's taught to us in the schools, it was always dumbed down into skeletons and death, right? For the evolutionist, death is the thing, the engine of creation. For us, it is the giver of life. And we didn't look at comparative anatomy of skeletons. We looked at the unique design of each and every animal. And that was the thing that was so fascinating. So it really is a blessing and an opportunity. I hope if you have the opportunity, you take that to homeschool your kids. Have a good day. Thank you.
If you can take a photo on a phone, there is machine learning in the background.
Highest quality video capture ever in a smartphone.
In the metaverse, we're going to need AI that is built around helping people navigate virtual worlds as well as our physical world with augmented reality.
Augmented reality is a profound technology.
That includes like your position in 3D space, your body language, facial gestures.
We invented new intimate ways to connect and communicate directly from your wrist.
Everything from virtual reality to designing our own data centers.
Describing what's coming even, it's just so different and new. I've been in this infrastructure business for, you know, 3 decades.
No one has ever seen infrastructure like
this.
Now, I expect that these trends will only increase in the future.
In the last few months, we launched voice and vision capabilities so that ChatGPT can now see, hear, and speak. Supports up to 128,000 tokens of context. That's 300 pages of a standard book.
That's all AI generated. Actually, let's add some Alto Cumulus clouds. All right.
Break free of the technocratic nightmare this Christmas and go back to basics with a David Knight Show bookmark and notebook. This high-quality embossed metal bookmark with a full-color design on the back is guaranteed to be cross-compatible with all physical books. And the beautiful faux leather notebook is 100% hacking proof. An ideal gift for fans of the David Knight Show or anyone looking to start a journaling or prayer journal habit. No bells, no whistles, just pen and paper. Available at davidknight.news. Merry Christmas.
What's going on, Texas? It's Bluff here. Do you like playing casino-style games like blackjack, baccarat, craps, and slots? Well, SpinQuest.com, that's SpinQuest.com, has over 1,000 games available for you to play from the comfort of your own home. New players get $30 coin packages for only $10 and instant cash prize redemption. Now, what are you doing? Put that barbecue down, quit sweeping those tumbleweeds, and get to playing.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Career changers, including veterans and active duty service members. Your transition starts here. Go from GI to IT in a matter of months. Become a certified cyber warrior with training at My Computer Career. Cybersecurity specialists are in high demand, offering IT pros great opportunities and a rewarding lifestyle while protecting our people, liberty, and treasured institutions from cyber threats. Deploy your career in IT today at mycomputercareer.edu/CWP, an elite CompTIA certification partner.
VA education benefits are available to those who qualify.